call the meeting to order. Ask for the roll call.
Gordon Ford?
Here.
Donna Riley?
Here.
Maria DeAnda?
Here.
Jason Borda? Mike Lynch?
Here.
Darren Garrett?
Here.
Michael O'Neill?
Here.
Jess Droga?
Here.
Jim DeMartini? Joan Clendenin?
Here.
We have a form.
Okay, thank you. Announcements?
I have none.
Glad you're going to make it easy on me. Okay. Public comment? Skip that one. Consent items.
Move for approval.
Second.
Second and approval for, and second for consent items. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Number six, annual update on direct lending Raven Capital. Let me make a couple of notes before we get started on that. That in the closed session, we have another item with Raven Capital. So action will be taken at that time. Discussion on anything, including what we do then, is covered at the beginning. This is our first meeting, I guess, on direct lending, so it's a new area for us. And I've had our staff prepare, if I could pass this out, some information for us. That is simply showing at the bottom of the report the cash that has gone back and forth, because at this stage we're in the commitment period, and primarily it's us giving money for the commitment. And we have our first report through September of the income and expenditures, I believe, and as I understand, December is in works.
Yeah, December will be here in the next couple of days.
Okay. So this is the best information we have at this time of actually what's transpired. And we're here to start off basically by finding out what's happened since we started.
Okay.
So with that, I'll give it to you.
Okay, great. Thank you. I was very pleased to get your invitation to come out here. I don't know if every manager comes out in person, but there was no way I wasn't going to come in person. So thanks for that. What I thought I would do, since this is my first report to you, hopefully of many, was to give you a fund update at a high level and then start to drill down into some of the activities that we've been up to in the last year. If you remember, which I'm sure you do, you approved the investment on our final close of the fund. So we had a two-year capital raise, and you came in at the end of that period, taking our total commitments for the fund to $152.9 million. You were a very sizable participant in our fund. We don't raise any additional capital over the $152.9. So between Stan Sarah and one other large institutional investor, who's the largest investor in the fund, you are a very, very meaningful and important investor in my fund. I think it's important that you know that. Leading into that final close, the total amount that we raised in April of 2013 was almost $74 million. So we were busy investing the capital we had at our disposal prior to that, but we did have a large close, which you made up of the majority of. And so we had 1 year from that final closing date to invest all the capital in the fund.
Okay.
And that's what we've been busy doing for the last 12 months. We've called $85 million of capital, almost $86 million, through February of 2014. And that was 56% of the total commitments to the fund. Let me just take a step back. The way our fund works and other private equity funds works is that we take committed capital, total commitment, a promised amount, and then we call it as we need it to deploy into certain investments. So through February, we deployed 56% of our committed capital. And some of that capital, all of that capital was invested in a total amount of almost $88 million, because if during our investment period, which was that two-year period, we received principal back on an investment, then we are allowed to reinvest it during our investment phase. Okay. And so we had received back about $3-4 million of principal, primarily due to the receipt of receivables. So those were, that was planned planned redemptions, and we were able to reinvest that into new investments. So we have outstanding, what we'd like to call a dry powder, of $67 million, and only a few months left to deploy the $67 million. But I want to assure you that the way our investment pipeline works is that we're constantly evaluating investment opportunities, and some of them that we decide to engage in take weeks, and in some cases months, to come to fruition. And oftentimes they never come to fruition. But we are currently in the process today of closing on two new investment opportunities. And when I say we're in the process of closing, it means we've tipped the scales on a 50-50 basis, greater to processing than not. And we have two opportunities. One is what we'd like to think is an infrastructure investment. It's a senior secured loan collateralized by reserves in a certain type of metallurgical coal mining equipment and a coal processing plant in Kentucky. That investment size is still under discussion, but somewhere between $10 and $20 million of first lien investment. And I'll talk about the metrics of that investment in a moment in terms of the expected return and duration. And the other investment that's pending is the acquisition of a ship, a bulker ship, a seaworthy vessel that carries bulk commodities like grain and steel. We think that is a very interesting market at the moment. For the benefit of the committee, we held an LPAC committee meeting regarding this investment, of which Jeff is a member of our limited partner investment committee, advisory committee, and we discussed that opportunity in great detail after delivering our investment committee memorandum, which is about a 20-30 page document discussing the investment opportunity, the merits for the investment, our analysis, and we do that for all investments. So if anyone here is ever interested in digging or drilling down a little deeper into any one of our investments, we can always send you the investment committee memorandum. So we're highly confident that between those two investments, the infrastructure investment and the ship acquisition, we'll invest another $40 million at a minimum, which will take us pretty close to fully invested on the fund. And that's our, there are other investments in our pipeline as well. We may or may not conclude those investments, but they're an acquisition of another aircraft and a loan secured by aerospace parts, equipment that goes into aircraft specifically. So the pipeline now is very active, and I think, I mean, for the benefit of the group, I don't feel any pressure to invest the money, even though that our investment period is drawing to a close. This is the natural way the business works, so it's business as usual at Raven, not all hands on deck. We only have 3 months to deploy capital. That is not how this works. The pipeline will live beyond this investment period, hopefully well into fund 1, 2, 3, and 4. And my team is very busy right now working on these different investments. So the total income generated from our investments to date, $6.4 million, of which we've distributed 92%. So if you're looking at the handout as of September 30th, there's been a significant number of distributions since the September 30th report. And you can expect that. I think when we talked originally, the Raven strategy is designed to make loans and investments in assets. Those assets generate current cash flow, whether through loan coupons and fees or the liquidation of a receivable. And as we deploy more and more of the assets of the fund and become more invested, obviously the distributable amount will increase. So we will be exiting our investment period, as I said, May 1 is the final date. And then we'll have 3 years of which to harvest our fund, the bulk of which will be the combination of a receipt of income from loan coupons and fees and realized investments, and the return of principal. And that's important because when you initially analyze this investment, you made a large commitment of an initial capital of $40 million. We needed the time to deploy it, and now you're going to see the fruits of those investments come back to you over the next 3 years. In fact, the longer it takes, even though we said 3 years, and every investment we have has an expected maturity of 3 years or less, but the longer those assets are working for you, the more money you make. That's how it works.
Josh, can I get you to go back a little bit and talk about the end of the commitment period?
And specifically, what would happen if there's an investment in the pipeline that you're really close to doing, but we bump up against this commitment period? What would your options be in that scenario?
It's a great question. It's actually covered in our LPA. So there's a mechanic built into the limited partnership agreement for that scenario. We would need to have an executed bilateral term sheet with a counterparty for an investment by May 31st to make the investment. And to be clear, our term sheets are not one or two page documents. They're 10, 15, 20 page term sheets, that's a function of the way we operate as an investment team. It's a function of how we operated when we were at Merrill Lynch. It takes the guesswork out of the investment once you get into the long form documentation. So that's just the way we do things. So you won't see a two page term sheet tucked in under the last second to make an investment. That's not going to happen.
Can you explain? You said May 1st or May 31st?
It's really April 30th, May 1st is the end.
So you need the term sheet by May 1st?
By May 1st.
Okay.
If we don't have that signed, we won't be able to call capital on the investment.
So would there ever be any situation or circumstances where you might consider or entertain extending the commitment period for this fund?
So the answer is yes, but that's not for us to decide. We would need to put that out to the limited partners as an amendment to our LPA. So that's not an insignificant request. If we are looking to exceed our concentration limits on a particular investment, we would go to LPAC committee. Of which you are a member. But if we want to do something material, like change the duration of the investment period, we would need to seek an amendment, which we can do. Mm-hmm. If we were to do that, it would be to close an investment we think we're close to making. And I think it would only be fair that we wouldn't charge fees to you on your committed capital for that extension period.
So if I understand it correctly, obviously, there can be something in the pipeline, but at some point, we will have invested some amount, say $37 million with you or whatever, and then that would be the close of the period.
Correct.
And it would be up to $40 million, but it could be a few less.
Correct. That's right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's typical. I would love to say we would be 100% invested, but it's not practical to hit it right on the nose, because it's not as if we can. We certainly won't want to overpay for an investment just to deploy capital. By the same token, our investments are sized due to the diligence and the research that we've done. So when I talk about a good example in the pipeline we're talking about now would be this infrastructure investment. It's either 10 or 20 because we're either going to be joined with another party that's investing alongside of us, or we're not. And I don't have the optionality to force them out of the investment, but I hope they're not in the investment so we can do all of it, but it's out of my hands. That's a common occurrence.
So at this point in time, our staff stands by ready for the $40 million commitment, and you would give a call, 5, 10, 20, whatever you need, and we would send it to you in a relatively short period of time.
Within 10 business days.
Yeah.
That's the...
And then after May 1st... You may have something pending, which you'd let us know, but otherwise they don't need to have a commitment set aside.
I think that's fair. I think would be more cut and dry than that. By May 1st, we will get a notice from us that we have a signed term sheet, that the deal is not ready to fund, but we expect to call capital within 30, 60
days. And they'd have a rough idea how much they could plan for.
They would have almost the exact dollar amount.
Very
absolutely
good.
Yeah.
I would also add it's probably industry standards that 85-90% of capital gets called, not the full 100%.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
So this is not unique.
No, and I'll say I'm pretty happy with our deployment to date, because we did receive a lot of capital commitments on our final close, which effectively gave us a year to deploy a lot of capital. But the opportunity set in the marketplace is excellent. It hasn't decreased in any way. It's only gotten better. Meaning the original investment thesis that I came to you with is still valid and viable, and it will continue to be so. So we're in a good spot.
Okay, now in the sheet that was just handed out, in the dark area, it shows the actual change of money. In other words, the money that we've sent to you, or as you say, you've sent some back to us from income. So we had capital calls 1, 2, 3, 4.
Oh yeah, you have it through February 18th. Right?
So we have it through current.
Yep, you
much.
Have a current.
And so that's what 22 million or something in that range that have been called. So we are only deployed maybe 50% at
just
this
over 50% at this
yeah.
point.
So we're deployed about 50% at this time.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is that when you fund pro rata of the investment. So
right.
It's my intention that we'll call somewhere between 40 and 50 million across the whole fund within the next 3 months. It'll take you to almost fully invested.
Okay.
That's right.
Now, the financials that are available, as I say, are only through September because you're still working on December. And if I look at that financials through September, and if I look at the calls that were done, there was essentially only one capital call of $10.7 million that we sent to you by the end of September.
Right. That was your that capital call. You made a capital call of $10 million on 5/22/2013.
Yeah.
That was your pro rata ownership of the investments we made before you became an investor in the fund.
Right. So that bought us into that
Correct.
Investment.
Right.
Now, of that $10.7 million, if I understand it correctly, a little over $1 million there went into management, $1,049,000?
Of fees. Right.
So that was fees because we joined into an existing...
Yeah, the way the LPA reads in industry standard is that you pay fees to the inception of the fund.
Okay.
Your pro rata share.
Right.
Right.
But I just want people to know what it is.
That's fine.
Okay, and as I understand the terms at this stage, we're paying you a fee based on the $40 million on a quarterly basis?
Correct. You pay 1 3/4 management fee
right.
on your commitment amount, which is $40 million.
Right.
That's paid on a quarterly basis.
Right.
And that stops as of May 1. You pay that 1 3/4 fee only on the amount of money we've invested.
Okay. So actually our fees go down slightly after we get through the commitment period.
They go down slightly because you will pay on the amount invested. They will also go down because our strategy is an amortizing strategy, meaning there's a return of principal that occurs through the natural life of the fund. So we'll be harvesting investments.
Right.
through the next 3 years. Your fees will decline significantly over the next 3 years.
I think that's something that they refer to as the J curve or something at the beginning.
The J curve is the, if you draw J, is it takes time to deploy the capital this way. And so once you reach that point, then it declines back down.
Right.
So that's correct.
So that when you talk about a fee of 1.7 at the beginning based on 40, if we have 20 invested, it's essentially twice that because you're paying the full fee.
Correct.
Okay. And the process, again, the counting is different for everybody. It's different than I would have expected. That's me. It's not a quarterly, we send the fee. It's encompassed with the call, or how does that work?
Oh, okay. If we can do it with a call so that we're not, and I don't believe that we've made any capital calls just to pay fees. I think they've all been netted either from profits that we've generated or they've been folded into capital calls. Just we try to, as an efficiency matter for you, so that you wouldn't have to send us a small wire for our fee.
Okay. And again, trying to understand that I'm looking at essentially only 4 capital calls that are listed down there, so I wanted to find out if we've sent you the management fee in that period of time, or if we still owe you, or if it's you charge
no,
later.
No, sorry. Okay, it's a great question. No, you're up to date through today on all management fees, okay. as reflected in the gray box below.
Okay.
Yeah. There's no additional or hidden fee in there.
Okay. So then, when I speak in terms of how much we've deployed or invested, I have to back out that management fee that we sent you, say the $1 million.
That's fair.
Okay. So, again, we're maybe a little less than 50% invested.
I'd have to talk to Chris to see how he notes that. But when we called, the capital we're calling, I believe, does not include that fee. So the invested amount of $87.8 actually went into investments. It's net of the investment fee.
Then I'm confused as how we would have paid you.
Well, at least they netted out in the statements.
So it might be 89 million called in 87.
Yeah, well, except we didn't have to call because we were generating income. There was a netting that occurred.
So they netted it out in the statements. We didn't pay additional capital fees.
Okay, so the distribution that came to us
would have been a net distribution,
out.
Correct.
Great.
That's right.
See, that helps me.
That's right. That's how it works.
Okay.
And the one of the beauty of direct lending is they're generating, the invested capital is generating income right from the start.
Right.
So we're getting some return, which will accelerate through the period of time, and that mitigates that J curve effect.
Right.
Okay. Ready? Anybody else? Questions?
No, feel free. I'll just keep going. Stop me anytime.
We
were able, obviously, our fund is audited. Rothstein Cass is our auditor. Our 2013 audit will be completed next month on time. So no issues to date. The Raven team added one investment professional and our controller since we last met. So now we're a team of five. Several people in this room are in constant contact with Chris Felice, our controller. He was a very, very good hire for a small firm like Raven. He came from a very large private equity firm in Palm Beach that was disbanding because the senior professionals were Mormons, and they wanted to go back and join the Mormon Church, even though they were managing $2 billion. So we were able to get Chris to come up to New York and join us, and he's been a really strong addition. Our service providers have remained consistent. I think for an annual report, if we were changing our attorneys or our auditors or our administrator, that would be a material fact you would want to know. We're very happy with all of our providers, and we will continue to use them for the remainder of this fund and hopefully for many more. I haven't had any issues with our service providers. I want to go back and quickly summarize exactly what our strategy is. I think when we get into the types of deals that we've put into this fund, you'll see how this is evidenced. But Raven is about making asset-based loans and investments. And we almost have a myopic emphasis on the asset. And for other investment firms that focus on public equities or public bonds or control private equity where they're taking... It's hard for them to actually understand why a group like ourselves would do such a thing. But we feel that the asset is such a strong component of our strategy. It offers us a significant amount of downside protection so that if for whatever reason our thesis is wrong, we're not looking at a zero scenario in any event. We've got real collateral that we can touch and value, and that's where we drive the bulk of our investment thesis. Current income is a crucial component of what we do. It's nice for you, the investor, because as Paul said, it mitigates some of the fee charges for a private equity strategy. But it also lets us as a lender and investor know that our investments are working. If the counterparties can't pay their fees or their loan coupons, that's a problem. So it's a nice way to make sure that everything's working, and it creates nice profits for our investors. The active management side of the business is really what gets us out of bed in the morning. It's interacting with our counterparties on a regular basis. We don't make investments, put them in the file, and hope that they come back to fruition. We are in constant dialogue with our counterparties. Constant could mean daily in some cases, depending on what we call the velocity of the investment. If it's a receivable and it's got a high level of turnover, we're in regular contact. It could be weekly, monthly. We see our counterparties multiple times per year. They come to our offices quite a bit. We keep an active dialogue open with them to troubleshoot any potential issues. It's a little bit of a different way to operate, but as I said initially when we first met, it's never been our intention to be the biggest lender in the space or the biggest investor in the space. We have a niche that we've carved out, and we're going to focus on that to make sure we do it right. And that enables us, with a small team, to be very hands-on with our counterparties. Our investment pipeline has been very robust. A testament to that is when you joined the fund. Your capital commitment of $40 million gave us the bulk of assets that we needed to become meaningful in the marketplace. $150 million is a lot of money, no matter how you cut it. We came from a very large shop at Merrill Lynch with seemingly unlimited capital, and our ability to go back into the marketplace under the Raven flag and let the industry know that the same process, the same professionals were now back in a position to make investments was meaningful. And it's been a very busy year, and it will continue to be so. There is no shortage of counterparties in the marketplace today across these asset types: receivables, specialty finance, commercial real estate, transportation infrastructure, that are looking for $5 to $25 million loans and investments. That is still the sweet spot in the marketplace. Above $25 million, you start to see some of the larger brand names that you're probably familiar with: the Carlyles, the Blackstones, the TPGs of the world. They like to make bigger investments because they have a lot of capital to deploy. And below $5 million, you see groups like the Small Business Association and community banks coming in to make loans. In between that, it's been a very very robust marketplace. Our portfolio composition is well diversified. It will continue to diversify when we make our infrastructure investment. But I wanted to give you a flavor of what you're invested in. And let me stress that each one of these investments was thoroughly diligenced, executed with third-party counsel advising. Many of them, we use third parties to advise us or value the investment. And we put a lot of work into our investment committee memorandum each time we made an investment. Even though we're a small team, I try to build a consensus among the team members for each individual investment, and each investment does require a full-form investment committee memorandum. So there's no shortcuts. We have a number of investments. I'll just run through them. Any questions, feel free to stop me. We made an investment in a medical receivables finance company. This is a group that finances medical receivables for healthcare providers. That was a $5 million commitment, but a 1.75 investment, meaning we gave them the capacity to grow their investment, but to date they're 1.75. And the reason they haven't grown is because we haven't allowed them to. The reason we haven't allowed them to is because we want to do diligence on each individual doctor that they're lending to. And we're probably not a great fit for this company, but they couldn't get capital anywhere else, so we've restricted their growth, but we're charging them 18% for their money, and they may have to go find another lender. That's okay. We have bedrock collateral, and we feel good in the investment. We had acquired a portfolio initially in the fund of pre-settlement litigation receivables. These are loans to plaintiffs in litigation. That portfolio is in a natural process of liquidating, meaning every time a case is settled, and there were over 800 cases when we bought the portfolio. They're down to about 550 cases now. We've collected over $10 million out of those cases. It will continue to realize over the next 3 years. I laugh because the only restriction on liquidation there is the speed of the court system, which is notoriously slow. Slower collection in legal settlements is actually a good thing in this case, because the fee, if you will, is on a clock. So the longer the case is outstanding, the larger our share of the settlement becomes. The danger in extension is that you just don't want these cases to become stale. So we have looked at this portfolio on three independent occasions, meaning gone to our counterparties' offices, spent a minimum of 1 week at their offices reviewing the receivables. We're going to do another one soon. I'm going to bring in a team. We're going to underwrite every single case in the portfolio next quarter. We made a loan to a consumer installment loan company. This is an online lender for consumers. This has been a very, very profitable investment for us. We initially committed $15 million of capital to the company. This was after they had $100 million of capital from a very large investment manager in New York. We put in 15 and then increased to 18. And then a sovereign wealth fund came in and invested 100 behind us. So we're in a very unique position. We're the $18 million gorilla in between two $100 million gorillas, but it's been a fantastic investment for us. Pays like a clock, 17% on a biweekly basis. It's just been a great investment for us, and the performance of the portfolio has been very strong. We acquired a pool of California workers' comp medical receivables. That was an investment I actually did myself last summer. We bought them from a medical provider in Southern California. So it's not a loan, it's an acquisition. We have a 20% targeted return on that. I think it'll be higher because we not only took, we not only factored in the speed of collections on the receivables, but we took warrants in the company as well.
How does that work?
How does...
The one like with the workers' comp?
So they, a lot of doctors use their receivables to finance their operations. So because the insurance companies are slow to pay, that creates a problem for a doctor. So the receivables generally used as working capital. So the doctor says, I need money to make payroll and grow my business. So I want to pledge to you, Raven, my aged receivables that are currently being collected at a discount to what they're worth so that I can have the cash today to run my business. And it's very, very common practice. The unique thing about the, and that's not unusual for a lender to do. What's unusual about this investment from Raven's perspective is that I negotiated as collateral not just the receivables that we were buying at a discount, but all of their other receivables too. They're non-workers' comp receivables. So we're actually 8-to-1 covered on this deal, which is good.
If it seems like it's not smart on the doctor's part, you're right.
Yeah, it's not, but yeah. Their alternatives are few. Yeah.
On the other hand, doctors do make money.
Yeah. Doctors charge.
That's why. So we also have investment in two Airbus A320s. It's the plane I flew on here last night. It's one of the workhorse aircraft in the aviation industry, probably not the most popular, the second most popular. We acquired two aircraft, and we're leasing them to an Italian airline called Meridiana. So there's two levels of protection in this investment. We bought these planes at a very, very attractive purchase price. And in the aviation industry, it's a very liquid market, so you can value a plane any number of ways, one of which is comps. What is that plane of that age selling for in the marketplace? And there's a number of resources that you can look at, like a used car. And then there's also the cash flow aspect of it is how old is the plane? What's the utilization? What's the rent that's being paid? And then you can take the sum of those cash flows, discount them back, and then once you take that into account, you say, what's it worth at the end of the lease payment, also like a used car. So we triangulated all those valuations. We ended up buying these planes for about $11.5 to $12 million each. To give you an idea of where the value is today, one of these same aircraft sold for $14 million a month ago, which sounds great. We're in this investment now for 3 years, so I'm saying we've priced it correctly. We've got protection from our collateral, but we also have a lessor who's making lease payments on it. And that's between the combination of the value of the asset and the lease payments, we're looking for a base 14% return. We could do better. I don't think we'll do worse. So,
and what's the collateral? Your other investments, you have a section where you have collateral or guarantor, but we don't have it here for the planes.
It's the aircraft themselves. The Raven actually acquired two aircraft, put them into a wholly owned Raven special purpose vehicle, and we own the planes.
You repossess them.
We would repossess them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And is it Ireland or is it Italy? You said Italy.
So
it says Ireland.
One of the reasons we got a good price on the aircraft is it was a multi-jurisdictional investment, meaning the sellers of these aircraft was a German-Russian leasing company. So for what it's worth, they were the seller. They took the purchase price and they're out of the picture. But because they were German and Russian, they had some tax concerns about where the assets were sold and structured. To put aircraft in a, they have to register aircraft no matter where they're held. These aircraft are registered in Ireland, and that's very common for aircraft for tax reasons. Ireland has very strong legal precedent and a very nice tax regime. So I know you're non-taxable, but it's important that we structure these investments from a tax efficient manner. So it's an SPV in Dublin. It has an affiliate in Luxembourg, as well, also for tax. And this is not tax avoidance, I want to be clear. This is an Ernst & Young blessed tax structure with counsel as well. So we didn't recreate the wheel here, but it seems like it's complicated. But ultimately, Raven Fund owns these aircraft. It's not a third party. We could literally reach out today and grab them, and you would own the aircraft.
And so the user is in?
The user's Meridiana. That's the Italian airline. They're actually based in Sardinia. So you'd say, why?
It's owned by Ireland, used by Italy.
The planes are owned by us. They're leased to a group in Italy.
Okay. Right, now let me ask you, I don't know anything about aviation, the aviation industry. What happens if one of them falls down?
Okay, so great issue. So anytime a plane is on lease to a third-party operator, the liability is on their account.
So they would pay us back?
So, the planes are insured at two levels. The airline is required to carry insurance for the aircraft. So God forbid something happened to the plane, the airline would have all sorts of claims with respect to passengers, et cetera, and property damage. The planes are also insured just from a pure property value. So if anything were to happen to the aircraft, it's fully insured. That's part of the investment that we make, we take an insurance policy.
So we would get the money back from the plane?
Correct. That's right. For what it's worth, trivia-wise, Meridiana seems like a strange counterparty. The reason we're using, the planes came with leases to Meridiana attached to them. If we were to lease these same planes to United Airlines, the rate would be 8%. So there's a risk that we didn't pick the right counterparty. And if they're not the right counterparty, we take the planes back. We have asset value when we bought them well. So if they gave us the planes back today, we'd make $3 million right off the top just for our effort. That's not our strategy. Our strategy is to put them to work to generate cash flow. But we chose Meridiana because they're well capitalized. They're a pain to deal with on occasion. Italians, no offense, like to negotiate quite a bit. So it was an interesting negotiation on a lease. But the airline itself is owned by the Aga Khan.
Awesome.
I don't know if anyone knew that. Aga Khan is a billionaire, and he's
Pakistani.
He kind of runs his own sovereign entity, but he's been capitalizing this business for years. So aircraft is a nice investment for us because we can deploy a good amount of capital into it, and it's got an asset base and the cash flows. Our next investment is
How long will that run out?
The lease goes till 2016, and they have an option to renew. So what that means for your duration is if they renew the lease, we'll immediately sell the aircraft because everyone likes to buy aircraft with leases attached to them. That's a good thing.
That's true.
If they don't renew the lease, we'll still sell the aircraft. It'll just have a different valuation, and we factor that into this. If they renew and we sell, this 14% will look low. If they don't renew the lease and we sell it, this is probably the right number. We have an investment in general purpose rail cars. These are tanker cars, brand new tanker cars, current generation. So when you read press, and there's a lot of it today about oil by rail and cars that are not suited to carry the product that is being brought down from the Bakken into the Gulf, these are the most current and the federally regulated cars in the industry. These are the ones you want to buy. So other cars that are out there will either need to be scrapped or retrofit. These are not that case. We have the best possible rail car collateral here. Same issue with the airplanes. Anything happens, the cars are insured for property value, and the liability goes to the user of the rail car, not to Raven or to our investors. So there's a shield there. This investment was designed to initially finance the deposit on 300 cars. It's our intention to put a term loan, meaning actually finance the 300 cars on a go-forward basis. Right now, that may or may not happen. We may get repaid on this loan sooner than we expected, and I'll report to the LPAC when that happens. If that happens, it's not a bad thing, but right now there's the company right now is in play, if you will. There's an acquirer there. So stay tuned. I don't see, there's no downside scenario here. I'm not sure how good the upside's going to be, so stay tuned on that. I'll report back to you on that. The last investment in the portfolio next to the pipeline is an automobile leasing company. We made a loan to a company, or actually acquired an existing loan at a very deep discount for an auto lessor in Texas. Most of the fleet are Toyotas. They hold their value. They're leased out to consumers and to automobile dealers. So when you go to a dealer and your car is serviced, and instead of getting the car you normally drive, they give you a Toyota. There's a method to the madness. Those dealers lease from people like our counterparty. They call it fleet financing. So we were able to make a $9.3 million loan that's collateralized by $20 million of cars and leases. So very, very well over-collateralized. Our target return here is very high because we took a current income on the loan, as we do, and we also took a warrant in the company. So every time a car is returned off of lease and it's sold, and that's how the business works here, we get a percentage of the sale price, and that adds to our return.
Were they distressed, Josh?
The company was not distressed. Their lender was distressed. Their lender wanted to exit this position. It was made by a group called Compass Bank. They were acquired by another bank, and they wanted to be out of the position. I'm not sure why. We didn't worry about so much. We want to know what the situation is for why we got the opportunity, but the collateral proved out to be exactly what we expected to be. It was an opportunity. So that's your portfolio. That's what we have. I can provide additional detail if you want. Like I said, it's available. But I wanted to spend the last bit here just telling you what you can expect beyond 2014.
Excuse me. Where are you in the pending category?
So
you have a pending category at the bottom, yep. Coal and vessels.
Okay.
Where are you in that process?
So those are the ones that I think we have a better than 50% chance of executing those investments prior to the end of the investment period. So with respect to the infrastructure, the coal investment, we have a signed term sheet. So we expect to make either a $10 or $20 million investment in that opportunity in the next few weeks.
And it's not a company that's going to be affected by these new EPA rules?
No. This is it's surface coal. It's met all their. Take a step back. The reason why we like this opportunity is because the counterparty has funded their operation with their own capital for 3 years to the tune of $40 million of equity capital. This is the principal's own money. It's taken them 3 years to get to the point by running the environmental checks and requirements they need to, the regulatory, to get to this point, and it's been expensive. So now they're looking to take a loan to complete that process. So they're in compliance with all EPA regulations.
Thank you.
No problem. Any other questions?
I have a quick question.
Sure.
So as Trustee Ford mentioned earlier today, we're going to be taking an issue to extend the term of the investment into closed session. And I just want you to reassure everybody here before we go into closed session that that's what's really going on.
Okay.
And that we're looking to extend the term of the investment, not the commitment period.
Correct.
Or the investment period. And it struck me, it looks like that's the reason you're doing
Sorry.
This, because the two pending and
gray. Okay.
Down here.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought that up. So what we have, one of the things we got wrong from a structural standpoint was that because we got a significant capital commitment on our final close, we had 1 year to deploy capital, and we also effectively burned through during that, while we're investing, a year of duration on our investments. What I mean by that is we want to give you investments that have a 3 year duration, meaning the capital's going to be put to work for 3 years, earning income, and at the end of 3 years, we want our money back. That's how you mitigate and amortize some of the upfront fees that you've paid. It's important to have duration to smooth out those payments. So if we were to make an investment today without extending the duration of each investment, we could only make a 2 year loan. And what we're asking for in the amendment is let us make these last few investments with a 3 year duration. That's all we're asking for. We're not asking to extend the investment period. As I mentioned at the outset, that's a totally different issue, and it would be a separate amendment.
Thank you.
Okay. So we, within the last year, we've gotten to know Jeff quite well. He's our LPAC member. We want to make sure that there's an open dialogue between Raven and Stansara. So I said this when I was here the first time. Any questions or comments, send them my way, or use Jeff. He's been, I've been on the phone with him many times. He's been to our office on several occasions. I've been here in your neck of the woods a few times in the last year and stopped by. I think what I want to communicate is that we will make sure, based on experience over last year, that you have any advance notice of any material events, either at Raven or in the underlying investments. Even if it's not a final ascension, that could be negative news, or it could be an event that needs to be explained in detail, or it could be positive news. So I just want to make sure that that on a go-forward basis, we'll make sure that you get that advance notice. We are very happy to have Jeff on our LPAC committee. I think it's been a good experience for you, I think. I don't want to speak for you, but the other members of the LPAC include BlackRock and endowments. It's a very good group of people, and Jeff's been a nice compliment to that. So I appreciate your time. It's not always that easy. One of the things we negotiated with you for the investment was for you to get a monthly net asset value investment. Not all of our investors get that. You do. So you know, we'll continue to do that, obviously, and you know, hopefully that's satisfactory. You'll get your quarterly portfolio reports. The next one will be coming out any day now. You also get the quarterly newsletter, which is me pontificating on the marketplace. You get our quarterly and annual financials with respect, and in addition to your capital statement. So the reporting, I think it's been received as you expected, but if not, let me know. All of my team, my investment professionals, would be happy or able to discuss any of the investments they're working on. I think that's a pretty unusual statement to make for an investment firm, but my team lives and breathes these investments, so if there's something that I can't answer for you, and I'm happy to put you directly in contact with the individual working on the investment.
Since you brought it up, and sometimes we put things in contracts that are details that are not that important, I think it's important to point out that in our site agreement on 8A, the report was to include discussion of the allocation of events vehicle managed by the general partner, in other words, how it's decided who gets what. And in 19H, each quarterly report shall be delivered within 15 days. You know, even our own annual report in the county is always on time, so I don't mean to push it.
Okay.
But I do need to make the observation that we have some things in here that it's difficult to meet with, and apparently the timing on your December has been a problem.
Okay. I'll need to look into that specifically, but I was not aware of that. I'll follow up on that for you.
Can you, Josh, beyond the investment period, which ends April 30th, just quickly summarize where we are at the market from a supply-demand standpoint? You said above 25 million, it's getting more and more competitive.
Yep.
Our sense is that expected returns above 25 million have come down substantially from 2-3 years ago.
That's right.
And in the space you're playing, kind of what are you seeing from that standpoint?
Yeah, so I addressed this exact point in the write-up that you'll be receiving in a couple days.
Okay.
I know you haven't read it, so but let's talk about it. So the a couple things have happened in the overall markets outside the typical public markets that you might be used to. So the capital markets are very efficient, and the banks were dominant, and I use the word bank sort of in quotations because Merrill Lynch was more of a broker-dealer, a trading firm than a bank, but we were a shadow bank. We were making loans just like any other bank would. So that entire industry, as expected coming out of the financial crisis, I had expected the business to be affected much more quickly than it has. It's taken a long time for the regulators to really implement the changes that they initially wanted to make. And that's probably a good thing because there were some pretty agitated lawmakers during the crisis. But what we're seeing now, and this has literally happened since January 1st, that the clock's up, meaning if you're Citibank or Bank of America or Goldman Sachs or any U.S. bank, if you thought you were going to be able to play in a gray area, which is to make investments like Raven does on your bank balance sheet, that's done. And that's evidenced by these larger firms selling businesses left and right. They're selling their commodities businesses, They're selling their principal investment activities. Their traders are walking out the door. And that's a good thing, I think. Now that I'm on this side, I can. When I was at Merrill, I'd say it's a bad thing, but now I'm on this side, it's a good thing because that reduces the risk that these banks are taking systemically in the system. But what that's done is that's driven a lot of talent and a lot of capital need outside the banking system. And if you if I read one of my write-ups 2 or 3 years ago, it's that could lead to a crisis because it could create capital problems for typical borrowers who say, I used to go to Bank of America to get money. They can't do that anymore, so what do I do now? Well, now that we're 5 years into the crisis, and you look back at it, it's almost been a seamless transition from the Merrill Lynch's and B of A's and Citi's to the larger private equity firms that are now no longer private equity firms. Carlyle and BlackRock and Blackstone, they do thousands of different business lines that they never contemplated 10 years ago. And what they've done is because they're not banks, they've stepped into the gap and now provide capital solutions to people just like the broker-dealers do. And a lot of those private equity firms are better capitalized than Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, Barclays were in the turn of the century in the 2000s, which it's hard to get your head around. You know, Merrill was a public company with $30 billion of capital backed up by public markets. And you have companies like Blackstone and BlackRock and Fortress managing $60 billion of capital from pension plans, endowments, foundations. So that shift has happened, and the banks are accelerating into that. So what does that mean? It means that little guys like us, we're the forgotten few. No one cares below $25 million. It's not going to be a meaningful investment for a large firm to worry about the $25 million and less opportunities. It just, they don't care. And for larger investments, $50 million and greater, there are a dozen different financial products in place today that can accommodate that type of lending. They're CLOs, collateralized loan obligations. Those are pools of loans packaged together and sold. CDOs, those are bonds packaged together. So the markets have remained very efficient. It's just shifted from the broker-dealers and the banks to these shadow bank players like private equity firms. Okay? And so the opportunity set for a group like ours, and I could not have predicted this to be the case. I mean, I knew I was seeing a lot of interesting things in the marketplace, but what this has done is it's really driven us to the forefront. If someone can't access that efficient capital, we get the phone call. And there's probably a half a dozen other parties out there like us today that are trying to do the same thing. That's not a very competitive landscape.
Is it because of the amount, like you said, the smaller amounts?
That's the initial driver. The initial thing, think about running a business or solving a capital need. I need $10 million, I need $25, I need $50 for whatever business operation. That's the first consideration. Once you've figured out what that size is, then you look at your alternatives for capital, and then it gets even more complicated. Who has the expertise to understand what it is you're trying to do with your business or what you're trying to borrow or what your duration is? That starts to enter the equation.
Because looking at the experience of the last few years and now, it would almost seem like the larger companies might be more difficult to get money from because maybe you've got a little bit of a iffy kind of product that you're selling, or from a R level perspective, credit ratings, that type of a thing. So is it more risk then? Are they riskier loans and they go with you?
Yeah. Or maybe the rules have changed?
It sounds like it, but...
Look, the answer is there is definitely more risk in the system today than there was a few years ago. There's a number of reasons why that's the case, but the firms that are now making those loans have become as efficient as the capital markets were prior to the crisis, and that drives competition, and that causes people to cut corners and to try to focus on volume. That's my opinion. But I will say, though, that the drivers of that, and this could be expected, the regulators had to expect that another system was going to pop up to replace the volume that was missing from the banks. And then the common sense stupid thing is that who do you think these guys are hiring to do it? They're just taking the bankers who got fired, bringing them in-house and saying, just do what you did over at Merrill, just do it for us. Mm-hmm. So it's the same thing in a different place. So that's good for the banking system because the banks may be more will be risk averse and maybe better capitalized to deal, but the risk has shifted. It doesn't help you guys, because I know you invest in these other large companies, and I'm not saying to stop doing that, but it's something to keep an eye on, definitely to be considered of.
It's unregulated.
It is unregulated.
It used to be regulated, now it's not regulated.
It is. Right. And then the other cautionary note is that if you let enough bankers and lawyers work on a deal long enough, the regulators will never figure out exactly what it is they've done. Anecdotally, I was trained in law. I went to law school, and I got a taste of Wall Street as an intern at Merrill Lynch in 1992, and I had no idea. I didn't even know what Wall Street was, believe it or not. I knew I wanted to be there, but I didn't know what it was. And I sat on a trading desk, and at the end of that summer, I went back to law school, and I sat in a corporate law class, and my professor had asked me about the different financial institutions that I had been dealing with, and I could only explain a fraction of them, but I said that I just spent the last 4 months, 12 hours a day working on this, and I can barely explain it. I can assure you that anyone in this room, it will never be able to understand it in that regard. You have to be in the business to understand it. So I think the regulators really focused on trying to reduce risk at the bank level, and I think you're starting to see that, but the risk has shifted. It definitely has shifted to the unregulated. So let me quickly finish up. Probably went over as it is, but so over the next 3 years, starting today, we do expect to invest another $40 to $60 million of the total fund amount. So to try to get you closer to fully invested, your quarterly distribution, your income will increase significantly.
Okay, now let's get a little bit of detail on that. If at the end of May 1st we've invested $39 million. Out of the 40, then we never go below the 39.
Correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
But you're reinvesting, if you counted all the reinvestments, we'll add.
So, yes, that's true, but we won't be able to reinvest any principal after May 1 either. So if we get a principal repayment, let's say my rail car investment, if they decide to pay me back on May 2nd, that's a bummer, but you'll get that money back. I mean, gotcha. Bummer for me, but that'll come through to you guys.
Okay.
It ends.
And we should expect about 6-7% a year?
I think it's going to be higher than that. So, if you had asked me that question when we first started talking, to be conservative, I would say 6-7% sounds like a good number. But if you look at the rates of return mm-hmm. in the portfolio I just discussed with you, they're all in the mid to high teens. So the distribution should be higher than that.
Great.
The fees go down, the distributions go up. That's what you can expect over the next couple of years.
Beautiful.
Okay. So as I mentioned, so that's, again, just finishing my notes, the management fee goes from committed capital to invested capital, and so as a result, your fees will decrease. We've asked for extension of the duration, but not the investment period, and to enable us to get a 3-year duration today will help us invest the rest of the fund. That's the key.
One other question that kind of nagging at me. The way your system works, you have to get 2/3 of limited partners to agree to something.
Correct.
That's for an
amendment.
Right. And from your perspective, that's good. From my perspective, that kind of implies that 1/3 of the limited partners could be brought along to something they don't want to do.
Right.
And that's reality.
That's
something we have to be aware of.
It is. And I think I didn't come up with that 2/3. That was a... Believe it or not, I actually took the advice of my counsel, which spoke to your counsel, and they agreed that was market standard. That was not one of the material business terms that we discussed. So that's
industry. What we could be brought along on would be something that, say, lengthens the duration, but not requires more money.
Correct. That's it. Oh, absolutely. That's right.
That's a better deal than democracy.
Boy, it's tough.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only change that I expect is to ask for the added year of duration. I don't expect at this point to ask for an extension on the fund.
Okay,
that would be beneficial to us.
I don't think so. And look, if there's money left over, I would ask you to consider reinvesting in our next fund, which would be
going into a new fund and new contract and all that.
Exactly. So it'll be substantially similar than. To this. That's the strategy of Raven, is to replicate the same product over and over again.
Okay. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to take up in closed session an actual vote. but I want to make sure in open session anybody has a chance to ask any questions. If not, we'll move on to our next subject.
All right. And before I leave, thank you very much for your time and also your support. It's not lost on me. You are a very, very important investor in Raymond.
Thank you.
Anybody have a problem if I adjust the line to cut down the water?
No, go ahead. Puts you up, Paul. Huh? Puts you number seven? You're up, number seven?
Oh, okay. We're going to go over the
7A. The
7A is the fourth quarter quarterly performance report.
Right.
I'm going to be very brief. The news is good, so there's no sense. And we're going to start on page one, which gives the capital market review. And the fourth quarter was a continuation of good returns in equity markets.
Well, we're going to come back to Raven, you know, in closed session.
No, just questions about this. What is this management free structure will switch from committed capital to invested capital? What does that mean?
We committed $40 million. Between now and the end of May, they'll come up with an actual amount we invest. Say it's $35
million. Oh, okay.
It then reverts to the $35 rather than $40 million. So the fee, which is 1.75%, goes down.
Okay. And on this sheet that was handed out?
Yes.
What is the difference between management fees, professional fees, organizational expense, and service fees?
That's something we kind of hoped you would ask Josh, but I think, Kathy, can you enlighten her?
There are different fees they charge and for different purposes, and they're all laid out in the MPA, and we have similar fees for all three lenders.
So that's customary.
Yeah.
It's cost.
It's like your phone. It's kind of
anyway,
like
anyway, doing it's a fee.
Yep. Gordon, go
ahead. It seems like a silly way to do it.
I apologize, Paul. We had
it's
moved
okay.
on.
I mean, they're all expenses related to the investment.
Yes.
And their
yes.
work on the investment.
Yes.
So why do they break it out into four sections?
I'm listening.
Why
Paul.
Do real estate brokers charge different fees for things? You know.
I don't know.
Be more
yeah.
transparent.
But that's the answer. That's just the way it's done.
Yep. It is what it is.
Let's go back to seven, Paul. I'm sorry.
That's okay. We're going to go to the fourth quarter 2013 of calendar year, our second quarter of fiscal year 2014 through December 31st. Page one is the capital market review. Equities had a very strong quarter. The S&P was up 10.5% for the quarter on the heels of good economic data released, including quarter four GDP preliminary of plus 3.2%, which followed the third quarter of plus 4.1% GDP growth. The market also dealt with well the start of the tapering by the Federal Reserve. We've been in 2 months now, and in fact, interest rates have gone down during that period. The emerging markets return only 1.8% for the quarter. They continue to lag as they have for 2 years now based on worries about China growth slowdown. Natural resources, which a lot of these emerging markets are dependent upon, have been stagnated as far as pricing power. And we saw Argentina and Turkey have currency crisis, which precipitated flows coming out of emerging market, and often flows in the short term will dominate technicals or valuations. And emerging markets, frankly, look very cheap today on evaluation metrics, given their performance discrepancy to U.S. and non-U.S. developed markets. But flows have been flowing out due to those various factors I just announced. Third bullet points on Europe. Often the best time for equity markets is when market participants perceive that a bottom has been in place and things are improving. They're still bad, but they're improving off a bottom, and that's often when we see equities run the most. And Europe ex-UK was up 8.1%, and in fact, recent performance in countries like Greece and Spain have been stronger than any other country in Europe. The yen fell for the fourth quarter. That's due to Abenomics and the acceleration in February after the Q4 of the program to increase liquidity with the goal of weakening their currency, which generally has the effect of lifting equity markets up. And the third from the bottom bullet point is on real estate. We do have a real estate asset class review, which we begun last month and will continue the discussion today. And you can see the NAREIT, the public equities, were weak for the quarter and 1 year period, while NCREIF, the private property index, has been very strong for three straight years now. Page two, the equity market performance, huge 1 year returns of the equity markets. S&P up 32%, NASDAQ up 38%, Russell 2000 small cap up 39% for 1 year, Russell 3000 total market up 10% quarter, 33% for year, and 16% for the 3 years. And then non-U.S. Good, but not as good as the U.S. with the EFI developed markets up 23% for 1 year. You see negative numbers, emerging markets 1 and 3 years. Bonds. Bond rates did rise during calendar year 2013, which led to a minus 2% return for the U.S. Barclays Cap aggregate. Although spread products continue to narrow, as evidenced by corporates and high yields up 7% for the year. And you see the NCREIF private property index at the bottom of page two. Let's go to page three. The equity market U.S. and the sector returns, dividend yield 1.8, P/E ratio at 20.6%. It should be noted that a good part of the equity gains in 2013 were due to P/E expansion, not GDP growth and not bottom line growth, but P/E expansion. Defensive sectors lagged for the quarter, telecom, utilities, prime example, and for the year. And for the 1 year, healthcare, industrials, and consumer discretionary, all in excess of 40%, led the way. Let's go to the next page, four, developed equity EFI. You see non-U.S., Japan for the 1 year up 27%, Europe ex-UK up 27.6, led the way. And for the quarter, Europe ex-UK up 8%. Page five is the...
You're
on the smaller book. Let us go to page five.
What does it take for us to get the bigger book?
Huh? Should have stopped me on the first
you
page.
You have two sets of books?
I printed the agenda book from the website. I guess it's different.
We're on five? Is that what you're saying?
Are we all on this? Is five this page?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. The fund stood at $1.715 billion at the end of December 31st. Let's go to page six, returns. Total fund return 6.3% for the quarter. That's 110 basis points of excess return, which is very strong for 1 quarter. For 1 year, 19.8%. That's 380 basis points. And you see 2, 3, 5 years all producing excess returns and ranks in the top decile versus other plans. All our active managers have added significant value during these time periods. Dodge & Cox Equity has definitely turned things around. Their 1 year number was significantly above the value 1000 value index, and Delaware continues to be a strong performer. In small cap, bottom of page six, Legato has done well also. 1 year, 47.3 versus 43.3. And then on page 7, Capital Prospects has been very steady, returning 200 to 300 basis points above the value index. International, our pairing of LSV Value and Pyramus Growth have also performed well together. LSV and Pyramus both beat the Acquiex U.S. for the quarter and the fiscal year-to-date, and one-year numbers and out are strong. Dodge & Cox continues to be a very strong fixed income manager for us over the short and long term. And PIMCO has been somewhat average over the short term, but since inception has added 70 basis points gross. Again, Dodge & Cox has about three-quarters, four-fifths of the assets, so they're driving the performance there. Lastly, on page 8, our REIT allocation is passive, so that's performed in line. And you see the direct lending for the one quarter and fiscal year to date. The fact that we're in the beginning period, in the J-curve period of not being fully invested in management fees on total committed capital, and combine the three managers have added positive returns, I think that's quite well, and we're off to a good start there.
Paul, I had a question. I was looking at the peer ranking mm-hmm. that you provided.
Yes.
And I'm interested in the Dodge and Cox and fixed income in particular. Those didn't seem to do very well in the peer rankings, and I wonder, you know, we're talking about them like we did, you know.
Well, you see, the they should be compared gross, that top line shaded, for one quarter, 1.1, and they're compared against the aggregate index, minus 0.1, the next to the bottom line. So they added 120 basis points. They're compared in a core universe of managers, i.e. managers who don't take too much risk from the benchmark. Mm-hmm. And 120 basis points in a quarter is significant value. And they're ranked fifth percentile, so.
The lower the number, the better, correct? The
lower the better,
right? Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And if you thought I was looking at.
So if you go out even 5 years, 7.7 versus 4.4, that's fixed income adding 300 basis points gross is in a core universe is huge, and that's why they're in the top decile. So
I'm trying to figure out. There was another peer ranking that I was looking at.
You know what? I might have picked up the wrong number.
Do you know what page that was on?
It's the peer ranking report that's
Rick.
5B. What I do is I take Paul's quarterly and just try to compile it so you see a running
time series. It's like a time series.
And,
yeah.
Your quarterly report looks really cool, but it looks a little different than it used to, so I think I might have grabbed the wrong number.
Okay, well, that would explain then why I'm
for the Dodge & Cox growth piece for 5 years. I picked up the number 9 when I probably should have picked up the good 9.
Maybe I just was looking at the wrong line. I'm just there. We go.
You got 7.7. Because
I'm let's see.
I will double check my report and make sure correct.
But why is PIMCO so bad? Or so 95%.
Well, it's not that they're performing in line with their benchmark. They take more macro top-down views, and it's been a market where spreads have narrowed significantly since the crisis. So managers like Dodge and Cox, who are very light treasuries and overweight corporates and mortgages, have benefited. Where PIMCO, with their top-down view, will tend to have a higher treasury
weight. So
their
peer group is the same as Dodge & Cox?
Yes, yes. They complement each other to a certain extent, although...
But they're measured against each other?
They're measured against the benchmark. I think one is always going to generally lag the other, and I think we look at them both as a combination and to complement... But that said, we've raised this before, and there have been some, as one reads in the press, some doings at PIMCO the last month or two. So I suspect we'll put an agenda item next month to discuss that and potentially take action.
On PIMCO?
On PIMCO.
Okay.
And the action might be just to keep, retain them as is, but I think it's worth discussing.
Yeah, that's probably the line I was looking at was the PIMCO one.
Yeah, PIMCO's been fairly benchmark. Oh, they
74, 63, 89.
I mean, not all our managers are going to be top ranked.
No. But
I'm just saying, and they're in there to complement Dodge and Cox for certain time periods where we would suspect when spreads widen, if they ever widen again, and I suspect they will in my lifetime, Dodge and Cox will probably underperform in that environment, and that's where PIMCO will probably add value. And again, our ratio is 4-1. It's not like they're equal weighted either.
Right. And a lot of it can also, I think, have to do with the, like you were saying, the peer group that it's measured against.
Yeah.
The core fixed income peer group, as you might imagine, is quite narrow. So like the worst performer and the best performer on an absolute basis is, on a relative basis, is quite interesting. On an absolute relative basis, it's consultant speak. It's quite narrow, so just keep that's food for thought.
But I mean, we're aware of PIMCO, but we're more concerned with organization issues, frankly. And there was an article in the Wall Street Journal today that read like a soap opera, frankly.
Yeah.
But it does raise some issues, and we'll talk about that next month probably. In the interest of time. Since we're on the same book now, page 10, on an attribution for a quarter. The good news is the fund continues to add significant value relative to its benchmark, 113 basis points. And you can see all three major asset classes, U.S. equity, international fixed income, added significant value. And our allocation effect, where we purposely have overweighted U.S. equities and underweight fixed income, has served us quite well over time, although it did hurt us a bit in January.
What's interaction effect?
Interaction effect is the third at least effective portion of the attribution. It's basically spillover. There's cash flows that take place during the month. It's the very kind of small, intricate changes, intra-quarter, that don't get captured in a holdings-based analysis. Holding-based means we're taking a look at the portfolio as the holdings look at the end of the quarter, so very specific point.
It's also selection and allocation aren't completely independent of one another.
Exactly.
There's some counteraction in between the two, and that's what that is.
That effect should never be big.
It never should be big.
That's correct.
Precisely correct. Right.
And then, so to summarize, we've been off to a great start fiscal year to date. We're up 12.3%. We've had 180 basis points over our benchmark. And all our active managers, with the exception of PIMCO, have added significant value, whereas PIMCO hasn't really detracted much from us.
In just the last year, it looks like, still over the long run, they've added value, which we'll see later on.
I will stop there in the interest of time and transgress to January if there are no questions. And I apologize for the confusion. Usually consultants create confusion when there's bad news, so the news was definitely good. January was a month of correction in the markets. Our portfolio was at $1.681 billion. We did make a revise to our current policy as we strive to reach our target policy over time, with direct lending at 3.8% of the allocation. Now on a current basis, we up that to 4%. We decrease international from 19 to 18 to be in line with our target. Fixed income, we decreased to our target 29.8, and domestic equities, we increased to a current weighting of 46.7. So what this means in the future, as we continue to get capital calls and direct lending, increase our real estate allocation, and finally, look at infrastructure. The source of funding will primarily be from domestic equities from this point forward. Page two, we were $32 million roughly, less than the prior month. As I said, this was the first correction we've seen in a while, first correction in the fiscal year 2014. Still $168 million over the prior year, including all retiree benefits paid on a monthly basis. Page three are each of the managers with revised current target policy ranges based on the changes. page 4, showing cash at very minimal levels in domestic equities and international, which in these positive months we've seen has very limited drag on performance. And page 5 is the performance summary on a monthly review. Couple of notes here. One, as I said, the market did correct. Markets correct 5% or more on average 3 times a year. This was the first time we've had a correction in excess of 5% from May of June of 2013, and was the longest we went without having a 5% correction since 2008. So it was a good long period of time. Markets correct 10% or more on average once every 20 months. The good news is this correction, which was anywhere from 5% NASDAQ to 7% on the Dow, it's been buy on dips again, and we've seen a V, and we recovered yesterday to new highs in the market indices across the board. So we'll see it, if it holds, a kind of reversal in February from January. From our standpoint, we did have nice returns in our two small caps again in January. Dodge and Cox continued to perform well, and domestic equity overall added 78 bips on a relative basis. And alpha of the 4 active managers in U.S. equity continued to be quite well for the 7-month period of fiscal year 2014, with Dodge and Cox leading the way up almost 5%. And collectively, we've added 300 basis points, 16.36 versus 13.4. Fixed income, PIMCO added a little value. Dodge and Cox was on a relative basis slightly below. And for the 7-month period, Dodge and Cox up 124, PIMCO down 33. And we've added 84 basis points there for the 7 months. As I said, we will formally review PIMCO a bit more next month probably. Direct lending, you see the 3 managers there, and their returns for the 7-month period. Again, I'm happy and pleased with these type of returns given the J-curve effect, and that's been mitigated by 2 factors. One, buying in their portfolios that had previously been built pro rata, and 2, the distribution of income. International, both managers added value. Pyramus had a really good month in January, and both have added significant value, excess return on the 7-month period, with international up 12.3 versus 10, which leads us for the total fund monthly return in line with the policy, down about 1.9%, slightly below policy. Fiscal year to date up 10.18 versus 8.58, adding 160 basis points, which is quite strong. And obviously, the rolling 3 years for all of the active managers look good with no concerns there. I will pause there to see if there are any questions.
Paul, just one more thing. On page 2 of that little group right there,
yep.
Is there any chance that at some point you could give us just sort of a detail of what that plus $168 million is?
Sure.
I mean, I'm just curious.
How much attribution?
You know, how much of that is like employer contributions and then offset by retiree payrolls and...
This is all a change in market values.
Because you were saying...
This is net of the things that John is talking about, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yes.
So you're at your...
So when you say it's...
Well, we're taking money out of the system every month to pay retirees.
Right.
I realize we take money in, too.
Well, that's why I'm just...
I understand what you're asking.
Curious, you know, the money in,
We'll work with staff to get that.
Thank you.
Well, I think, I mean, frankly, I don't think we should call anything excess returns until we're at 100%
There'll be no good reason to ever call it.
Ever again.
We'll call it a
good returns would be good.
Change in value from prior year.
Yeah.
Beat the benchmark.
Yeah.
But excess of price.
We have
bourgeois.
The next item is a that goes along with the performance report is the review of the status of the managers. the review list for quarter ending December 31, 2013. And as one can imagine, when one looks at the value added over benchmarks and the rankings, everyone is doing a good job, and we recommend everyone, keeping everyone in good standing. Next is top 10. I wanted to say two things though on the managers. Delaware, we pressed out a memo based on a new announcement that came out February 18th, where Delaware is creating a new entity called Jackson Square Partners. And basically, over the next 2 years, we'll be transitioning from Delaware to this new entity. Jeff Van Hart and his team will own 50.1%, and Delaware will remain a minority owner at 49.9%. The main reasoning behind this is Jeff Van Hart and his team has a desire to have more direct ownership and be their own entity. My suspicion is, as Macquarie took them over a couple years ago, that there's been, although still amicable, more sticking points between the two firms, and they're using deferred comp primarily as a coin to buy themselves out. We view this as a positive because the team will be independently owned as a majority owner in their own shop. And we think over time they'll have the ability to go from the 50.1% to a higher percentage. We'll continue to watch that. The other note was PIMCO. One of the reasons we wanted a more detailed discussion is not only all the going-ons there, but the senior PM who was accountable for our account is leaving the firm as part of all this that's been going on there. A new senior PM has been assigned, but we will report next month to you on what's been going on there, including recommendations for that portfolio.
Hey, Paul, just a curiosity about the Delaware deal.
Yes.
Is that they're foregoing their next 2 years' bonuses?
Deferred.
Yeah, who decides how much the bonuses are, and do they get them like people get cost?
They have an agreement placed with their parent on what percentage of revenues after expenses goes to Jeff Van Hart as a team and what percent goes to Delaware.
This is after their salaries?
Yes.
How much is it?
A very big number.
It's enough where I don't lose sleep over them. I don't know how much, but I know that Delaware, I threw out a number of, so if you own if you make 50 basis points on your $23 billion and you keep 50% and Delaware keeps 50%, Kevin Brown, who comes here every 6 months, stated that we don't make 50 basis points. It's a number lower than that. So say 35, 40 on $23 billion. And so that's $80 million, say. And they don't keep 50. Delaware gets more than 50. So say it's a third of eight. I mean, they have $25, $30 million to distribute in bonuses, would be my guesstimate, back of the envelope. A lot. Top 10. Top 10, as I said, this is taken from Monday, the 14th. You can see the returns of the markets: 1,000 growth up 3.4, 1,000 value up 3.2, 2,000 value up 1.7, and 1,000 growth up 3.4 at that point in time. So we've seen a good reversal in February, and nothing really significant to report on the top 10 across the board. A lot of our managers from their top 10 positions are looking to have a decent month. More issues up and down, and a couple issues up double digits month to date. Okay. I think it's real estate time, huh? Yep, real estate. Okay. We prepared a memorandum for this meeting on the 2014 proposed real estate implementation plan after our session last month. And our main objective today is to select a long-term real estate target mix. That's our primary goal. Based upon that, we would go and implement filling up what we choose with real estate funds in the future, kind of backing off what we did last month. Page two, we talk about cap rates, where they are, from 5.7 to 6.1%, and that's the income one expects to receive in year one divided by the market value of the property. Cap rates don't appear to be too attractive, but like everything else, it's all relative to the 10-year treasury, and when you compare it relative to the 10-year treasury, the spread's anywhere from, say, 3 to 3.5%, and you can see the average spread's been about 2%, so still somewhat attractive on a relative basis. Page three looks at REITs. I think from last time you could tell that we were a proponent of definitely not adding to our REIT allocation, which is currently about 1.25% of the total plan. And again, we have 3.5% allocation to real estate and potentially using REITs as a source to fund private real estate. The yield on global REITs is about 3.6%, about 50 bits below the average. REITs have been a very strong performer up to about a year ago, where things have slowed down. And a real estate consultant who we jointly service a couple of other of our clients on a monthly basis or a quarterly basis comes up with metrics on REITs, and they're in the what they call the trim area, so they're somewhat negative on REITs right now. Frankly, we have a large allocation to equities outside of REITs in U.S. and non-U.S. Actually, a small segment of U.S. equities will be REITs, and we think the argument for going 100% private makes sense due to correlation benefits and having a better match of long-dated real estate securities to longer-dated liabilities. Bottom of page three, we have given three alternatives to consider for a long-term mix in real estate. We're more than willing to listen and come back with others if these aren't sufficient. Our expected returns and risk, briefly, public market REITs, we have a 6.2% expected return, 18% allocation. That's from our capital markets. And then private, on core value add and opportunistics, we have 7, 11, and 15. These are kind of standard industry standards for the privates we presented last month. What we did was we took a 10% risk for core, and we calibrated risk at the same levels for a value-added and opportunistic based on their expected returns. Our alternatives, one is a third of each, a third REITs, a third core, a third value-added. We do not consider opportunistic for any of these mixes, as we said last time, we consider that to be too risky. Often it's land development, other things that I prefer not to be involved with on the private side. And then you see expected return of 8.3 and 13% for alternative one. By including privates, it smooths out the returns and lowers the risk due to some correlation benefits versus the current 100% in REITs, which we would argue is not a worthy portfolio.
Okay, so Paul, you're going to be recommending today either alternative two or alternative three, which consists only of private core and private value added.
Correct.
Can you very succinctly explain the fundamental differences between private core and value added?
Yeah, core tends to be kind of properties that are more fully leased. They tend to be in the more desirable cities, the New York, Seattle's, Washington, D.C.'s, Chicago's, Dallas of the world, of the country, that are in demand, are already leased, and they're more income-oriented type of properties.
Apartments, senior living, things.
Industrial.
Industrial. And a lower return to follow.
So you're recommending sell out of the REITs and redeploy into the private?
Yes. Value added tends to be buildings that are in secondary cities. They are generally close to fully leased or fully leased, but they're in the Richmond, Virginias of the world. The
Charlottes.
Thank you. Yes, exactly. They tend to be also in those same primary cities as the core, but they're not fully leased. They're 75-80% leased. And part of the additional expected return comes from the external operating going from 80% to 90% lease. There's less income involved in value added than core, and a greater opportunity for increased market return potential.
Appreciation.
Yeah, appreciation. Thanks.
Okay.
Those are the primary differences.
And what is, for alternative three, you got three-fourths, one-fourth. What's the rationale behind that?
I just picked a number that seemed reasonable. That's all. I mean, it was easy to start alternative one at 30 each, and alternative two is 50-50 core value added. I just went with a quarter, three-quarters. The argument is that there's been such a demand for core real estate by institutional investors, primarily pension funds, that it's driven cap rates in those primary cities down to levels. They're still attractive versus 10-year treasuries, but the return, the value-added space is perceived to be more attractive than core today on an opportunistic basis. That would lead you to number three.
Okay, I have to ask.
Yes.
Between alternative number one and alternative number two,
yep,
the standard deviation falls.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some point at which the standard deviation is at its nadir?
It's at?
Its lowest point.
It's right at alternative two, I would argue.
There's nothing.
It would be a curve, right? So the minimum variance portfolio, it would be like this curve. And so it's a gradient process.
Yeah.
So picture like a...
Yeah, I just wondered if there's a rough guesstimate
would be very close to alternative two.
Paul,
I could do more iterations.
On alternative one, we would simply be peaking up the private core and the private value added and leaving ourselves in the current REIT?
Yeah, we would. Well, the REITs are... Yeah, and we're at one-third of 3.5%, so yes.
So alternative one would be simply adding private core and
right. We would add private core and private value added, and the source would be U.S. equities. And we would probably find one manager in each slot. That'd be from a implementation standpoint, putting inside return risk. That'd be the easy one.
It'd be easier. But what does it say about the equity risk? What's the correlation between the REITs and the equities?
Public REITs?
Yeah.
100% correlation.
Yeah.
It's probably 0.75-ish. It's high.
It's high, yeah.
It's going to be higher than that.
Well, in January, we saw REITs were positive 2% and the equity market sold off. So there is some variance.
I guess my point
but over time, will be...
In short periods of time, there's going to be a variance.
But over time, it'll be very high.
Right.
That's
but
why...
The markets value that asset on emotion, and not the underlying building and the rents that that building is supplying to the portfolio.
But we could go into one and later into two. I mean, we could do a transition, too.
Yep, we could.
Okay.
Paul, we talked last time about managers having stake in the investment. Is that a different requirement? Does that come later, or is that part of these alternatives?
Yeah, these managers in a core private fund will have capital inside the ground that will be invested in the fund.
So is that only for the one, or is that for...
So maybe that's, it would be that leads us into the structure, open-end versus closed-end?
It depends on the firm. I mean, J.P. Morgan is a huge player in core and value-added real estate and open-end funds, and their investment professionals are prohibited from investing in these vehicles from their bank trust or some kind of structure issue. So it really... We can go out and search for a manager who has skin in the game, though. That could be a criteria, and that would eliminate the J.P. Morgans of the world, and we would bring you other funds that the partners do have their own capital invested.
Is that wise to do or not?
Is it wise to invest?
The debt restriction on...
That's a tough one.
Well, I think it just depends. You know, what we're looking to get out of the investment. I mean, in general, it's a positive when management
yes.
has funds and their own capital.
I would say yes.
You don't think that there's some point at which, because they're personally invested, there's a tendency to hold on to a dog longer?
Well, and they're under the same requirements that we are. So their capital is not, their terms are not preferable to us. So they're in the same terms that we would have.
When they're not looking at it quite as objectively, they tend to hold things a little longer.
You mean in an adverse situation where, let's say, an asset's not performing well, maybe they would believe in it overbelieve. Yeah, I mean, that's what
could
be an issue.
I can't.
No,
I can't say one way or the other.
Personal
sure. I can't say one way or the other.
Capital in or not in matters in that scenario. Because if I'm a manager and I've got a dog, no matter if I have my own money in it or only your money in it, and I'm being judged on my ability to manage that asset.
Exactly.
That's where you want to look at the incentives, where they get paid a performance-based fee, a hurdle above 8%. And I mean, if their hurdle's above 8% and they're in the dog, you would think that would override anything.
Remember, a lot of these REIT portfolios, these private REIT portfolios, Paul's right on it, they get their pop, they make their money at the end. So they're being compensated to make really good management decisions, because everything over 8% hurdle, they're going to get some form of a split, whether it's 85-15 or 80-20.
Right. I worked for a limited liability partnership in San Francisco many years ago, but I just remember that they were very tied to the properties that they owned.
Yeah, I think it varies from the firm, really. That case, maybe they were in. Then if you went to work across the street, another firm it might be different. Yeah.
I mean, the real incentive is a short cycle of the portfolio.
So I think
that's when they get their pop, is at the end.
Like I said, I think our main goal today is to pick a allocation. Right. After that, we'll briefly go over the implementation plan, and then together we can decide kind of criteria to bring funds to you to fill those buckets.
Can you spend just a minute or two discussing the differences between an open-ended fund and a closed-end fund?
We included this month from last month, and that's on
page 10.
Thank you. On page 10, where we look at the structure, open end and closed end. And an open end is a fund that generally goes for a long period of time, perpetuity, not that long, but. It gives you immediate diversification, generally, because you're buying into an existing portfolio. And you have rights to redeem quarterly, so there's definitely more liquidity than a closed-end fund where you don't have liquidity. And the concerns are there's sometimes delays to get in and out, actually, especially some of these core funds. If we bring you a core open-end, there's a line up to get in these funds, so it might be a while. And then on the close end, it's kind of like our direct lending partnership. It's not really any different. There's a finite life, and can be more specialized, specific strategies. Frankly, those are funds where we would tend to see more skin in the game by the general partners running the fund. But it's illiquid, and it would tend to be more the boutique and organizations. Although there are some large funds like Blackstone and real estate also doing that.
how generally how do these close-in funds end? What's how do they go away?
There's a long. I mean, these aren't 3 to 4 years like direct lending type. They're much longer. They tend to be 8 to 10 years with extensions, and typically they end with kind of a small tail at the last year or two, where they're disposing of the final properties. There are some closed-end funds that are, you know, more 4 to 7 year range, and that would be something we could consider if we went that route. I think the only jumping ahead of ourselves, in core, we would look for an open-end fund, and value-added, we would look at both.
Okay. Obviously, having pension liabilities that are long duration, liquidity doesn't concern you that much. Is it worth, you think there's a good extra bang for your buck by taking serious consideration of the closed-end fund versus
the
open-end? Oh, yeah.
I think we mentioned it last time. There's one out in the market now that we're familiar with, think very highly of, and would bring forth to the board, definitely.
Also, one other question. The closed-end funds, would they require more legal diligence? I'm assuming the answer is yes.
Yeah, they would be more like a...
direct lending?
Yeah, they'd be more like a direct lender type of thing.
They're also
sure.
The funds that have co-investment, right?
Yes, they're more likely to have skin in the game, as you say.
Yes.
We're talking outside counsel of some sort? Different than we have?
No.
Scott does real estate.
Thank you.
Well, yeah. Both of them would require diligence, but yes. It seems to me that the closing fund would require
a little
diligence.
More, yeah.
Okay. But it would look remarkably similar
to direct lending.
But it was a huge education that we've gone through.
Right.
Maybe it's going to benefit as we look at this now.
Okay.
Paul, on page 5 of 5 on the item we're talking about, number 2, I knew we're going to go into possibly 3 for the term, but for the open-ended funds, what are the potential fees to get in and out?
Generally quarterly.
Yeah, but they'll, the fund that you're looking at, if they have a queue, will give you an estimate on how long to get in. They know based on what their queue is and how much dollars are lined up and what their investment pace is, kind of when, you know, we would accommodate you probably 9 months from now. And to get out is an issue more on when things are stressful, like 2009. And investors wanted to get out, they couldn't, you know, funds realistically couldn't let everyone get out without selling all the properties at a fire sale prices, so they gated that. In normal times like today, it's less of an issue getting out.
So that kind of begs the question, is there more discipline from the investor's perspective by being in a closed-end fund versus an open-end fund? And when I say discipline, I mean with respect to pulling the trigger if something doesn't go your way. Like in an open-end fund, like Invesco, for example, you know, they had a year or two of bad returns and it was reasonably simple for us to pull out of that investment. A closed-end fund wouldn't be so easy, correct?
Yeah, I think that's why on the close-in side, we would prefer, much like direct lenders, smaller operators, like an American Realty versus a Deutsche Bank type of
thing. It almost seems like closed-in funds tend to play into the idea of a long-term investment, which is what real estate really is, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, I agree.
Okay.
But an open-end done correctly can achieve that.
Sure. Yeah. I'm just not, I don't know the advantages or disadvantages in terms of liquidity premiums being in open-end funds, given our situation.
Right. I think, you know, if we went 100% private, it probably made sense to have a combination of the two.
Yeah. Okay. So what we want to do here is ask the board about the allocation, probably alternatives 1, 2, or 3?
Yep.
Okay.
Well, maybe before we ask the board, what's our staff recommend?
Well, Paul recommends alternative 3, and I would agree. I think that putting a little more in the private value added is the way to go. I would, if, and I know we're not asking you this today, but if I were to have a tendency towards open or closed-end funds, I would also go more towards closed-end funds if I could. But I would choose alternative three as well.
Even with the lower Sharpe ratio?
It's not that minimally.
It's noise.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's
right.
They're equal.
If we did alternative three, could we split private value added into two managers, the 75%, so 3750 across?
That would be our recommendation.
Okay.
And one in core.
But let me ask you, why are we doing core?
Well,
one core and two value added for three total.
Right. So we could either go 75% for one private value and 25% for one private core manager. Or we could do one private core manager for 25% and split the 75%, 3750, mm-hmm. across two other managers in the private value added space.
Right.
That would be three managers.
Yes, and we would bring managers to select, but I would not be averse to having one open-ended, one closed-ended value added.
In the value added. I agree.
My preference is alternative one. What other people want to say?
I don't know why we... I really think we should have the co-investors. I don't know why we would not have that except in extraordinary circumstances, which this does not seem to be right now in terms of these formulas.
If the board chooses, regardless, whatever alternative, two or three, that's something that we can consider when we bring the managers forth later on, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay. So we could preface our search that leans more towards folks that do have skin in the game.
Yep.
Have what?
Skin in the game. In other words, they have their own money in the game as well.
We would make that a requirement. Okay. Yeah. There's enough funds out there we can do that.
Very good.
But we're not advertising. Your other recommendations that we don't advertise, right?
What's that?
That you recommend that we don't advertise.
I hope we don't.
So, but,
I mean, that's an alt. I mean,
mums of
we usually advertise for.
No.
Some funds do go out for open RFPs.
Right. No, I said prefer not to go that route.
We don't have to.
I just wanted to throw that out as an option.
Anybody hasn't spoken?
I like option three because we're dividing it up a little bit more and we are looking long term.
Any other voices?
And one of the things we've been looking at and talking about.
Good.
It does have more volatility in it, though.
Yes, it does.
A bit more. You don't get extra return for nothing.
Yep.
We do have the capacity, though, to withstand the duration and
yes.
the volatility that goes along with these investments.
It's just 3.5% of
exactly.
our yeah, portfolio.
That, I thought it was noise.
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 Loud in here.
Oh, okay.
Everything's noise.
There's white noise, which is good.
Can you call for the question?
What question?
Alternative.
Well, we need a proposal of some sort or more discussion.
I'd like to make a motion to go with option three and divide up the investments accordingly, 25% into core, divide the additional 75% into two value-added, half of which would go into open and the other half into closed.
Now that is specific.
Good.
Okay.
The memory's working right now.
Very good.
Is there still discussion or is this?
We need a second for a motion to continue.
Well, I'm not sure I will vote for anybody who isn't a co-investor. So I don't want to approve a formula that says a third of what we're going to do is going to be open.
I don't think Maria's motion precludes your concern. I think we can tackle that after
yes,
we do
that's
this.
Implementation.
Mr. Chairman, in order for this discussion to continue, I'll second the motion.
Motion and second.
Now I'd like to hear some of the
discussion.
So, Paul,
I didn't get that detail.
Here's my question. Oftentimes in these REITs, you'll have a core satellite strategy, right, where it's there's the manager himself or their team would be 75% core, 25% value added within the same REIT structure. So how are we determining that allocation? So if we use KBS, for example, and they're 75% core, but then they have a 25% value added component, same exact portfolio. How does that play out in this asset allocation recommendation?
I think funds are primarily categorized as core value-added opportunistic. Some do have sharing between the two. We would be cognizant of that and propose funds that primarily are in the core space for core and value-added for value-added. It's not black.
So strict to the style box.
It's not black. It's not totally black and white, but we understand that.
So is it possible that if we chose alternative one, we may not go with BlackRock? BlackRock.
BlackRock's a public REIT. Oh, if we did.
If we did alternative one, is it possible that we would choose another REIT?
I don't see why we would, because it's a passive index fund, and we are of the belief that it's not worth spending your risk budget looking for active REIT managers.
Jason, that's a really good point. Just to add to the conversation on what you brought up, sometimes those managers will allow in their investment mandate the opportunity, like you said, to go in what they would be deemed core investments. But oftentimes when they pull that trigger is when there's been dislocations in the market. And now they have a sale for core assets that are getting returns very similar to value-add property. And so it's more of making sure that we partner with managers that we believe have the capacity to be able to discern what is value-add and core given the market environment.
It's not black and white. It's like a U.S. domestic equity manager that buys 10% of their portfolio in non-U.S. stocks. That primarily they're U.S. equities, but they do stray a little bit.
I just wonder why we're pinning ourselves down to an asset allocation recommendation before we've been introduced to managers.
That was my
and
suggestion.
Their style and process.
That was my suggestion. I think that last week we were starting to, 2 weeks ago, we were starting to really get away from the core discussion. And what I wanted the board to do was to decide the allocation and then capitalize on Paul's knowledge of good investment managers and bring those forth once we've decided how we want to allocate those assets across the space.
There's enough good managers out there where we could pick an asset allocation, have ranges around them so we're not tied to them exactly, and then bring good managers to fill that close to possible.
We don't like them, we continue the process, right?
Right.
Do we have a timeline for when these, should we go with whichever of these options? Do we have a timeline for actually the investment? Reviewing managers?
I should have done one. I mean, there will be a implementation plan where we would, probably propose criteria next meeting and start bringing managers in April, May.
But that would...
And I can't guarantee when it will be completed because it's...
It takes work.
It's at the pleasure of the board whether they're going to like these managers or not.
Right.
There's no rush either.
Yeah. No, I mean, that way I can see why, you know, you could go either way, whereas... if you choose your strategy first, then you can target the particular manager.
I mean, I could bring in six fantastic value-added managers, and you'd be 100% value-added potential, you know, if you went that route.
Uh-huh.
I'm not worried based on what you pick, one, two, or three, or additional long-term target, that we won't be able to fill that with good managers.
Right.
But I think, as Jason said, it's important to consider these factors. And you're going to have ranges around targets, too. So if you hire if you're 25% core, 75% value added, and you hire a core that's strictly 25% and value added that's 80% value added, 20% core, you'll deviate a little above your 25% core, but you'll have ranges around that to accommodate that, or vice versa.
Any further comment?
Do we need to also say in that motion that we're going to sell out of the REIT?
We can, I think, just by choosing alternative three, which has zero implies
right,
that.
I was wondering if we're going to get out of that passive.
Mm-hmm.
Get out of it.
Is it assumptive? It's an assumptive motion.
No. Yep.
Source of funding.
You've been very creative. can we go for a roll call vote?
Can we modify the motion to include getting out of REITs?
Yeah,
does it matter?
You can amend your motion.
Okay. Was Jeff the second?
Jeff the second.
So I would modify my motion then to include, so it's on the record, getting out of REITs.
So we need a second to that.
Second will agree to that one.
Very good.
Well, we can always change manager. Well, can't change manager once you're in.
We should have it.
You're kind of
well, open end you can.
Open end, but close end you're in for the duration.
Yeah, it's.
But we can change this allocation.
Because that memory is starting to test.
We'll have ranges around it too. So,
Kelly, you ready to reread the motion?
Okay, I'm going to give it a try. The motion is to accept alternative 3 to allocate the overall target allocation to the real estate asset class. Which is 3.5 or a total of 58.8 million, 25% private core with one manager, 75% private value added with two managers, one being open-end funded and the other being closed-end funded.
With no allocation to REITs.
With no allocation to REITs.
Right, with public no allocation
to REITs. Public REITs.
With no allocation to
public. In other words, selling what we have.
Traded or public.
So this means that we are approving open-ended.
Yes, and closed-ended.
Part of it.
Oh, just part of it. One third of it or so.
Good job, Kelly.
We're mixing it.
When you're ready.
Okay, roll call vote.
Excuse me.
Yes.
I just want to make sure on the 25 and 75. This motion is not saying that 25 is going to be one of these two investment alternatives.
Yeah.
And okay, so
no,
that can land anyway.
That's 25%, and then you take the other 75%, and you divide that basically in
half.
Yeah.
And we're going to have some money, we don't know how much, invested in open-ended, and some money invested
correct.
In closed.
Correct.
Okay, I understand. Correct.
Balance.
Roll call vote. Gordon Ford?
No.
Donna Riley?
Yes.
Maria DeAnda?
Yes.
Jason Gordo?
Yes.
Mike Lynch?
No.
Jim DeMartini?
Yes.
Darren Garrett?
He stepped out of the
hall. Michael O'Neill?
Yes.
Jeff Grover?
Yes.
So the motion passes.
Okay. Anything else on this item? How about a break?
Yes.
Okay. Let's take a 10-minute break. Okay, we'll call a meeting back to order. Next item on the agenda is Chiron. Graham, it's all yours.
Thank you very much. Nice to see you. I have a brief presentation. I'm not putting it up because you have copies in front of you. I just want to start off that I think the basic preview of the actuarial valuation this year is that their costs are up, but there's no huge surprises anywhere. What I'm showing you are the preliminary valuation results. We are still computing final numbers and doing peer review. We actually have already changed these numbers slightly because of some things that have happened with pay raises happening at the county safety. But just to take you through sort of the topics, we'll just go through the summary and highlights of the June 30th, 2013 valuation. We'll talk about what has changed since the prior valuation and some recommendations we have, and then just go through some closing remarks. Turn to slide 2, the executive summary, or page 3. We have three columns here. The first column is the valuation from last year as of June 30th, 2012, which determined the contribution rate for the fiscal year ending June 30th, 2014. The next column shows the results under the same assumptions and methods that we used last year, and then the column to the far right shows the results under the assumptions and methods that we're recommending be used for this valuation. One thing you'll see is that the actuarial liability actually it increased, and we were expecting it to increase if we use last year's methods. Remember, we've been talking about this thing called the entry-age funding method ad nauseum for the last few years about making this one change, and that's the big driver of cost increase that we're recommending this year. But one of the other side effects of that is that it moves some of the liabilities from prior service to future service. So that's why you see, if you compare the actual liability in the second column and the third column actually shows a slightly smaller actual liability of $1.92 billion. Actual value of assets, $1.524 billion. And if you compare that a few rows down, it's almost the exact same this year as the market value of assets. So at this point in time, your smoothed value of assets and the market value of assets are almost identical. You saw an improvement in the funded ratio from just about 77% to over 79% on the smoothed basis. We also saw a larger improvement on a market basis in the funded ratio from 72.2% to, again, 79.4%. And the reason you're seeing that bigger improvement in the funded ratio on the market basis is you had good returns in 2013. But you remember, part of what our smoothing does is it recognizes past losses, and it takes some of the gains that you had this year and defers those for future years. Looking at an increase in the contribution rate from 20.7% up to 21.66% under the old methods and assumptions. And I'd say just, we have that projection spreadsheet that we use every year, and we show you how we project costs are going to go up from year to year. That middle number is pretty much right in line with what we were projecting it was going to be based on last year's results. And then we look at 24.22% under the new assumptions. And again, after the revisions we've done in the last week or two, that 24.22 is looking more like 24 flat, just around 24%.
So, Graham, if I do read between the lines and do the math, there's still $1.1 million of unrecognized losses to be distributed later on.
That's correct, which is, for your plan, almost nothing in terms of deferred gains and losses. I think the market value is 100.1% of the actuary. Okay, so turn to the next slide, sort of what got us from last year to this year. You earned almost 14% on a market basis net of your investment expenses, compared to your 7.75% assumed return, so you made more than your assumed rate. But if you look at the smooth value of assets, your assets only returned 7%, which is about a $10 million loss, and that increased the contribution rate by about a third of a percent. You had about $110 million in losses in the prior fiscal year. You earned about $80 million more than you expected this year. So, you take one-fifth of each of those things are being recognized in the current year, and the $110 million in losses was slightly greater than the $80 million in gains, and that's why you saw the actuarial return on assets of 7%, which is below your 7.75 assumption. Any questions on this actuarial asset smoothing? Demographic changes, right? That's rates of retirement, disability, death, other terminations, individual salary increases, and overall payroll growth. That increased cost by about 0.6% of pay.
And that does not include the safety assumption.
It does not include the safety, because that's a forward assumption, not something that happened from last year to this year. I'm going to go out on a limb here. We did an experience study last year, right, that covered through 2012. You're going to be due for another one in 2015, or that will cover the period through 2015. You may have heard some news in the last week about CalPERS and their mortality assumptions. Several of the plans that I work with, several 37 Act County plans, have had similar experience to CalPERS, and we have adopted similar assumptions to what CalPERS has in terms of projections of future mortality. The Society of Actuaries has been coming out with new tables about how they think that there's been research done about how mortality is expected to improve. When we get to your next experience study, you should be prepared for more conservative assumptions that will be increasing the contribution rates, perhaps significantly. Just up the road in San Joaquin, the last experience study we did for them, which covered the period through last year, their contribution rent rate went up by 6% of pay from increases to the more conservative mortality assumptions and lowering of their discount rate.
So you're saying people are living longer, and that's the
people
assumption.
Are living longer, and people are expected to improve in more expensive ways for pension plans than they were before. It's not necessarily that everybody's living longer. It just so happens that it's the people in their, you know, late 70s and early 80s, which is what's expensive for a pension plan, that is driving the contribution rates higher. Now, I'm going to say
so
one thing.
Do we use the rates that CalPERS is now changing?
No. You use a set of standardized mortality tables called RP2000, which was the sort of the most recent large-scale table that had been produced, and then we adjust that based on your experience. So we looked at your experience, and we said, you know, on average, are your retirees more or less healthy than are being predicted by this RP2000 table? Just last week, there's a new table, RP2014. They're very creative with their naming conventions. So we will be looking at that new table and comparing it to your experience the next time we do this. We may also look at what the CalPERS rates have been, because they are looking at public sector employees in California, right? Probably a not a bad thing for you to compare to. But I just wanted to put that out there. You see that there were some demographic losses. I haven't tracked down all the sources of those, but I assume that some of those are likely to be mortality, and that is sort of a thing that's been going on with a lot of public plans. One thing that San Joaquin did, they, you know, about half of their increase was due to mortality, about half was due to reductions in their discount rate. They did smooth they phased in the impact of these assumption changes over a 3-year period, so the county wasn't hit all at once.
Is San Joaquin's longevity assumptions the same as ours?
Well, not anymore. They now have something that's more like
California. They were out of whack.
They were pretty close to yours. Everybody was using the RP2000 tables with some adjustments.
Are you talking safety or safety in general? I mean,
talking
general,
everybody.
General and safety.
General and safety. You know, by and large, most systems are now using, if not identical, at least very similar assumptions for general and safety members. You know, it used to be that safety members had higher rates of mortality, that they died earlier. That has not been the case in the public sector over the last decade or so. The safety members have really caught up in terms of health to the rest of the general population.
Is this a big enough concern that we ought to do anything rather than just waiting?
Well, I guess some of these comments are probably directed at some of the attendees in this room. This isn't something that's going to hit the books next year, but you know, will be coming and has been significant. I mean, it's been in the news for CalPERS. They had some major meetings last couple of weeks. The governor was weighing in on it, saying, you know what, go ahead and adopt these new assumptions as soon as you can. We're really not in a position to look at them this year. We need, you know, we do those experience studies in regular 3-year intervals. But I would say it's if you saw your contribution rate going down next year because, you know, you had deferred gains or things like that, I would probably urge the board to, you know, be cautious about reducing contribution rates when you think something like this might be coming down the road fairly soon.
Whoa. Okay.
So on this really happy, you know. gets me to the next slide, which is about the actuarial cost method change. I don't want to go over this one in detail because I think we've hit on this in every valuation for the last 2 or 3 cycles. It was hit on in your audit that Siegel did for the county. It was also highlighted in the audit that Siegel did for the board. Both, you know, us and Siegel and others recommending that you change from the entry age to decrement methodology to the individual entry age to final decrement methodology. That would increase the contribution rate by 2.13% of pay, but it would also increase the funded ratio by just under 5%. This new methodology will be required for your year-end financial statements. So regardless of whether you adopt this for funding purposes, we will have to calculate this set of numbers for your disclosure statements. And also, this new methodology is the one that's being used for your PEPR tier, for your Tier 6 members. I also have to say that the old methodology, the entry age to Decart methodology, is not supported under the Chiron valuation software, which is ProVal. It's the industry standard. Our old EFI system did, but if you choose to stay with that funding methodology, we'll have to charge you more just to maintain that old valuation system because we're phasing that out. That was one of the things you saw in Siegel's audit, was that they couldn't even calculate those liabilities. So, we also had to change our software internally. If you're using the new methodology, which you have to for the GASB stuff and for the Tier 6 PEPR members, we computed new contribution rates under our new software. It actually ended up reducing the contribution rates by less than 0.1% of pay. We were very happy to see that close of a match. It wasn't a surprise because we knew Siegel had, gotten fairly close to us on those revised results. But it was nice that for us, we didn't see any change in cost when we changed our internal software. And then we have two recommendations about changes to the economic assumptions that impact the cost by about 0.5% of pay. Probably a little less with our new revised numbers. That 0.47 is probably something like closer to 0.3%. But, as you know, we've had a pay freeze assumption in effect. So we've been assuming no growth in general wages. We still assume that members will, move through their salary progressions. This is the last year of that 0% pay freeze, and we were informed that the county safety members have already agreed to a 13.4% base wage increase. It didn't seem right to, assume those 0% pay increases for a number of years when we knew they were in effect, and not to also acknowledge a pretty sizable pay increase that we knew was in effect. I hope that someday soon we can go back to just making our baseline assumption of, whatever it is, 3.5% every year. But when there's a large pay change like this that you know is going to occur, we think you should build it into your assumptions.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to say something about that. That was a swap, for retirement contributions. And it did not include all of the safety people. It only included certain unions.
Okay.
And that's not a real big part of the county workforce either.
That's not how I understood it.
The supervisor's correct. The 13.4% increase was for our Deputy Sheriff's Association. What essentially was happening, they had given up raises over the years in exchange for the county picking up a portion of their employee contribution. We call that EPMC, Employer Paid Member Contributions. Under PEPRA, we're no longer going to be able to pay EPMC on people hired after January 1st, 2013, once the contract expires. We didn't want to be in a position where we had two classes of deputies, those who the county picked up their member contribution and those who did it. So we essentially swapped in the average contribution we were paying for deputy sheriffs, which was 13.4%, and we gave that to them in base salary instead. So now they have to pick up their contribution. We also did that with custodial deputies. We've done that with emergency dispatchers to a lesser degree. I think theirs was 8%. Who else did we do that with?
Probation was 8.5.
Probation was 8.5. So all those bargaining units where we had some form of employer paid member contribution, with the exception of attorneys, I think they're the only ones still outstanding. They would contribute like 3% to them. But as the supervisor said, that represents less than half of the county's workforce that were in that kind of situation.
I think way less than half.
Way less. I think it's more like a third.
I would think 30% at the most. Unlike cities, who have about 80% of their workforce and fire and police, the county has much smaller in law enforcement and really big in social services, where the cities don't have any
It is less than, definitely less than half. I think quite a bit less than that. And we only applied that higher wage growth assumption to the safety, the county safety employees. We didn't apply it to the general employees. We didn't apply it to the special districts or series or the courts.
But the point is, you're putting it in.
We are putting it in. Or we're recommending we put it
in. It's in the numbers here, or you're
going to? It is in the numbers here.
Okay.
The other change to the economic assumptions was an action that this board took to change the interest crediting for employee contributions, the refundable portion. That was increased from 0% to 0.25%. I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that this, out of those two things and how those impact the contribution rate, the crediting of 0.25% on employee contributions probably might round to zero. I think it has a very small impact on the contributions. So if you turn to the next slide, slide six. Sorry if it's a little hard to read, but this is this is sort of a summary of the changes and how the cost was impacted from last year to this year, going up from 20.73% of pay to 24.22%. And again, that bottom row, the economic assumptions, that is probably lower than 0.47. It's probably more like 0.3%. So we're looking at a net employer contribution rate of about 24%. Under the new cost method, under those revised assumptions, and reflecting all the other changes from last year to this year. We still need to put together the final valuation report and have you, provide us direction on the assumptions and the methods to use. So you can give the employers the contribution rates to use for the year that starts July 1st. We are recommending adoption of those two assumptions, the wage growth assumption for the negotiated county safety increase and the refundable employee contribution rate interest crediting policy. We recommend that you use the same assumption, all other assumptions, the same as the 2012 actuarial evaluation. And then we do recommend adoption of the actuarial method change from the aggregate entry age decrement to the individual entry age decrement, so you don't end up with two sets of books. So you comply with what your actual audit has recommended. So we don't have to maintain a legacy valuation system for a whole host of reasons. One other thing that we would need to confirm with you is that you're still comfortable with your amortization policy. Remember, a number of years ago, it was extended to 30 years, and then you brought it down to a 25-year closed period as a level percentage of payroll. And that's been coming down by one each year. Last year it was 24, this year it was 23. We assume next year it will be 22. You need to maintain a closed amortization period if you're going to be able to use the same expected rate of return for your funding and for your new GASB disclosure policy. We've done a few sessions on the new GASB standards, and one of the things is you can't have any kind of rolling amortization if you're going to expect your assets to cover the benefits for your current employees. And that's the trigger that determines whether you can use that same discount rate for your funding and for your disclosure. So we think it's wise to maintain that closed amortization period. We also know that there's a lot of organizations out here. There's that California Actuary Advisory Panel. There's the Conference of Consulting Actuaries. The Society of Actuaries released a blue ribbon panel thing yesterday, all of which are recommending people use shorter amortization periods, something like in the 15 to 20 year range, to amortize their gains and losses. So we don't think you need to set up anything like special bases this year. We think just taking that 23 year period and continuing to bring it down is a good idea. And then once you get down into that 15 to 20 year range, we can talk about developing a funding policy that might have different layers for future gains or losses. But we're comfortable with that policy now, having it continue to contract, and we'd recommend that you stay with that.
There was something about the length of time having to go negative and then come positive again, but as you get shorter, you didn't have that problem?
Negative amortization.
Yeah,
right?
You
are still in the negative amortization range. You probably will be until you get down into the 18 to 19 year range. Where the actual dollar amount of the unfunded liability payment is less than the interest on the unfunded liability. So your unfunded liability in dollar terms is still expected to go up next year, but your funded ratio is also expected to improve, right? It's kind of like the federal debt, right? It might go up every year, but if it's not going up very fast, your overall indebtedness as a percentage of your GDP might be going down.
So the difference between 22 and 18 or 19 has it or doesn't have?
Yeah, so that 18 to 19 year range is kind of the sweet spot where generally you're making a payment equal at least to your interest on the unfunded liability.
Is there a way to calculate how bad it'd be to go to the to that area?
I can bring that number to you at the next next time I'm here.
Last year, I think we looked at it and it was around 3%.
My guess it would be about somewhere on there.
Yeah.
But if you add into that an additional 5%.
Okay. So you're basically recommending we go from 20% to 24% on the employer contribution, and then a year and a half from now after the experience study, we could likely have another 3% increase.
Well, other systems that I've seen, changes in mortality have increased by about 3%.
So
they're 3 to 4% cost. Some of them have chosen to phase that in over time. And then there's other changes that if you're making changes to your investment portfolio, if your investment advisors have different changes about expectations about return, there are other changes you might be making to your assumptions at the same time.
But what we're looking at is if that held true. And we had to do it all at the same time. We're looking at going from 20.73% to 28%
and 18%. It's hard to tell because it also what's going to happen to your investments over the next 2 or 3 years, right? At some point, your amortization policy starts amortizing that unfunded liability, and your contribution rate is supposed to start declining. Really looking forward to the meetings when I can start actually telling you that. I think I got one of those in since I've been here.
Yeah. Would it be safe to say that, given the pressures that are out there, everything that you suggested, that there's an upward bias of between 5 and 10% on the rate on an absolute basis over the next 3 to 5 years?
10 sounds pretty high, but...
Between 5 and 10.
Yeah, something.
Well, and that means, in terms of the county, that means like a 25%. Increase in what they've got to see this dance area right here.
Yeah, it's about 5%. That's $10 million on the $200 million payroll,
which has a direct correlation to loss of service.
Yeah.
So, Rick, real quick, on the pay increase for the safety members, was that the pay increase was they used 13.4% across all safety
they
categories?
They did, but we just kind of talked about
so
that.
So can we make sure that it's accurate to reflect what actually took place?
Yeah. Again, what my conversations with Nancy were, we agreed. We knew that not everybody got 13% pay increase, but we figured that the correct answer is going to be between 11 and 12%. So we figured to be conservative, we would just apply it to everybody. It's probably not going to lower the rate much if we lower it to 12%, right?
No, it won't change it. I mean, again, that 0.47 is more like 0.3, so
yeah.
If you cut it to
13.4... Well, I understand. I just
want to
make sure that it's what we're approving and adopting today is accurate.
I will also say that what that affects is the liability for the safety officers, right? Because your liability is based on what your projected benefits are, and if you've got higher wages, we're projecting higher ultimate benefits. So we also are assuming that their pay is growing faster. So when we calculate that amortization payment as a percentage of pay, that actually kind of, to some extent, offsets some of the cost increase because we think you're going to have more payroll in the future, so you don't have to pay as high a percentage of pay to pay down that unfunded liability. We isolated all of those calculations within the safety population, so that those, when you see the ultimate, our evaluation report has different contribution rates for general and safety and series in the special districts. That pay increase won't affect the rates for the general employees or series in the special districts. It only affects the safety employer contribution rate. And it doesn't affect the member contribution rates at all.
And then those new employees are 2% of years of service. rather than three.
Yes, the new employees are in PEPRA.
Take that into consideration.
Yes, you have PEPRA members now. So anybody hired after 1/1/13 without reciprocity is now in the lower tier, both for general and for safety.
You brought up again today something you talked about before, which is a phase-in strategy on these larger changes. You said that San Joaquin has adopted a similar policy or strategy. So help me understand what that would look like if we're talking about over a three-year period.
So we've talked about that document, the California Extra Advisory Panel, the funding recommendations, funding policy recommendations. One of the things that it puts out there as an acceptable method or practice to do is when you have changes in assumptions, and we'd also include changes in the actuarial methods as an assumption change, since those are not regular occurrences, that it is acceptable to phase the impact of those things in over a period of time. And it said that the period of time shouldn't be longer than the time between your next experience study. Right? So for you, you do experience studies every 3 years, your next experience study is 2 years from now. But if you've got changes that are occurring, you could phase in the impact on the employer contribution rate. So let's say I had a 6%, increase in contributions from my assumption changes and from my method changes. And if I were doing a 3-year phase in, I would actually pay only 2% more this year and then an additional 2% the following year and then an additional 2% the year after that. When we've done that kind of an approach, we've actually made it a little more than 2% because some of the boards that we've worked with have at least asked the sponsors to pay the interest on the shortfall. Right? So if you're paying 2%, you should have been paying 6%. There's a 4% shortfall, and the board has said, you know what, employers at least pay the interest on that shortfall. The other thing to keep in mind when you do a phase-in is that you end up 3 years from now at a slightly higher contribution level, right? So if you were, because of that shortfall in the contributions, I didn't make that 4% of pay contribution this year, I'm not making that 2% of contribution the next year, that is going to carry through in my asset value 2 years from now, so you end up at a slightly higher contribution rate. I think for San Joaquin, it was basically a 6% of pay increase. They phased it in over 3 years. And they're looking at something down the road where they're paying 30 or 40 or 50 basis points more for a longer period of time due to this phase-in. I'm comfortable with phase-in approaches. I want to make sure, if it's something that you're interested in, that you're still, and your counsel is comfortable that you're complying with the CERL. The CERL does require that you amortize things over a period not to exceed 30 years. So I think you'd want to make sure that your payment is at least equivalent to a 30-year amortization, but I'm not too...
I think we've already discussed we're below that right now. Mm-hmm.
You're using 22 years, but I'm saying if you were to phase in and not make the full contribution, would you still be below what a 30-year amortization payment would be?
The implied.
The implied.
Right.
I think, and I feel pretty confident that you would be. The actuary advisory panel and myself... not really comfortable with phasing in regular gains and losses, right? Because that's stuff that is being remeasured every year. You're already doing smoothing on your asset value. So really that document really focuses on this kind of phase-in for the impact of assumption changes and method changes, which don't happen as frequently. Does that answer your question, Darren? Or were you actually asking about specific numbers for...
Yeah, I want to know. I mean, that's what we're here to discuss, specific numbers.
Okay.
And
so,
I want to hear from you and staff what this is going to look like.
So that method change was about, 2.13% of pay, right? If you were to phase it in over a period to your next experience study, that would be a 2-year period instead of a 3-year period. Basically, that cuts that in half. Maybe not quite in half, because maybe you want to actually charge back the interest on the shortfall, but probably cuts the contribution rate by, I would guess, somewhere around 1% of pay. So that 24 coming down to something like 23%.
And what would a 3-year look like? Right.
So instead of two, you'd be saving 1.33% of pay.
But then in 3 years after the experience study, you get that fix plus the longevity fix.
Right. The longevity fix is one that I'm already sort of telegraphing, that these things, other systems have seen these things be large enough that they have definitely looked at phasing the impact of those things. I had a system adopt the administrative expense change that you did, and they decided to phase that in over a 2-year period. I think you may just want to make it a common practice that when you have assumption changes, you phase them in over the time to the next experience study. That would be a reasonable policy to make. But I think it would also be reasonable to look at it sort of on a basis of, well, what are we looking at? What are the county's needs? There may not be a point in phasing something in if the county's ready to adopt the higher contribution rates right away.
I think that was a little bit more than what we were calculating at 16.8%.
Well,
our assumptions were less than that.
That estimate of the impact on the for the change in the funding method was pretty close to what we've estimated in the past. I think it was a few basis points higher. The change due to the assets, actually, contribution rate came in a little better than we expected from the assets. We expected the contribution rate to go up by, I think, over 1% of pay this year just due to asset losses from, phasing in the 2012 asset losses. You did have about 0.6% of pay in demographic losses, so that's, unexpected losses.
So, Graham, if we phase in the increase due to the cost method change, that would mean, and we do it over 2 years, and because 2 years until our next experience study?
That would be my thought, but, okay. This is the board's policy. The board has discretion over funding policy.
Okay, so that would mean we could reduce the bottom line, the end rate here, by about a little over 1%, which would equate to about a 12% increase in the rate relative to last year instead of the 16.8. Is that something
I think we can live with that.
Palatable.
I'll let her see. I think we can live with that.
Yeah, can I adjust the board?
Yeah, let me, first of all,
I haven't seen you in a while, so I'm going to do that for you. I just want to say up front, I've always appreciated the way we've been able to work together with the Spencer board, and your staff is just terrific to work with. Rick and I were having conversations last night, late, and early today. We at the county kind of share your same goal to get Spencer in the obvious position. To that end, Graham's been wonderful about sharing some of this modeling with us so that we could go out and kind of do our own forecasts. And so we at the county do a five-year long-range model. We're modeling through 18, 19 already, trying to figure out how we're going to balance our budget. And two major things that are on our radar screen that we're concerned about is how to fund over 400 and something new jail beds that will come on in 2017-18. That represents about a $14 million hit to our general fund. But the other thing is since 8-9, retirement rates have increased, down 58% since 8-9. Just in the last 2 years alone, retirement rates have increased 36%. So you can imagine that's a huge hit when you're taking those kind of increases in your retirement contributions. But we've known GASB was something that the Stansair board wanted to get to, and so we've been modeling it. For whatever reasons, our modeling ended up with a little bit different results than you're seeing here. We've been modeling about a 12.9% increase in the general fund. That represented about 2.4 million that we were going to have to come up with more next year, and it represented about 5.4 million for all county funds. When we saw the stuff come out on Friday with the numbers that are in front of you, we suddenly set out, because that difference between 12.9 and 16.84 represents another $1.6 million to all funds and another $750,000 to the general fund. So, you know, as Rick and I talked, we're kind of in this quandary. We don't really want to recommend that you go with the existing assumptions and go back to the 21 or whatever it was, because we recognize that these are things that we need to start doing, you know, working with you on to move the to a better funded ratio, and we recognize the pressures of GASB. But we're kind of steaming from the 16.84%. That was a little more alarming than we've modeled, and that we feel like we can absorb this coming year. And so we really like the idea of phasing in the GASB changes. And so we would ask that you consider that. The question, 2 years or 3 years, we'll just defer to your board, whatever you want to do. Any kind of relief that you can provide to us as far as some phasing in of the GASB, we would appreciate. We hear the concerns about the storm clouds on the horizon with mortality rates and everything else. We're hoping at some point the benefits of PEPRA start kicking in, and we're able to start seeing some savings in actuarial liability once that hits. But I don't know. Funding retirement is my second biggest concern after funding over 460-something new jail beds coming online.
Stan, so the 16.8 was a surprise to you? So if you guys were sharing the data, why was it a surprise?
We're not actuaries, and so we just have rough tools that we use in our modeling that we know are not precise sciences. But for example, the impact of the employer paid member contributions, that whole piece we didn't see coming. Some of the other assumption changes,
I don't know.
For whatever reason, we were modeling just under 13%. I will say one other thing. County employees right now are still taking a 5% pay deduction. And they have what helped us survive. The county is seeing modest signs of improvement, but we're a long ways from being back. We used to, before the recession, we had about $180 million in discretionary revenue a year. At the peak of the recession, that dropped down to $140 million, so $40 million less. Today, we're back to $160 million. So we're only halfway back. All 12 labor agreements expire in June of this year, and we're going to have to come back to the bargaining table and try to figure out how we're going to go through the next few years. But this change in GASB doesn't, in fact, I'll tell you what concerns me more, is not the impact on the employer, but the additional hit on the employee. Because my employees are still taking a 5% pay cut, this would add essentially another 3/4% pay cut to them. If you look at the impact of normal cost on the employees. So the ability to phase it in might make that more negligible to the employees where we get to the bargaining table and hopefully something
like that. I want to actually point, the phase in won't affect the employee contribution rates. The employee contribution rates are already based on the entry age to final decrement methodology.
Oh, well, that's good.
So help us understand, Graham, why the big, I can't remember what page it's on.
So those ones are
there. On page 9 of your presentation, employee contribution.
Mm-hmm. Why have those gone up?
Why is that going up so significantly?
Part of that is because of PEPRA, right? So your employees that are in PEPRA now are paying higher contribution rates than the employees that they were replacing. In some cases, some of your employees don't make contributions after 30 years of service, right? And when they're replaced by new employees, those members are making contributions, so that skews up the the average contribution rate.
That's not inconsistent because...
But you won't see, the individual members won't see it.
Pre-Pepper employees are paying more, a higher percentage of normal cost than a post-Pepper employees are.
Some of them are. But then you also have the employees that aren't paying anything right now being replaced by employees that are paying.
Which are younger.
Right.
Could be.
We are not recommending any change to any of the member contribution rates this year other than the Pepper people. The only thing that changes is the average of the number of people.
So this is a natural progression regardless of GASB.
Right.
Okay. So nothing, if I'm an individual employee.
Like, we publish the employee contribution rate tables in the back of those, in the back of the report. Those won't change. Except for Pepper members, and they by law have to be half the normal cost.
Well, that's good news, except for, so you're saying all of this is related to Pepper then on page 9?
PEPRA and the replacement of people that have passed 30 years of service with new hires, I think. Okay. I'd have to check what the ratio of those things
is. So this is an average, this 9 by 2?
Yeah.
Some employees are paying nothing, some of them are paying their pre-PEPRA rate and then post-PEPRA rate. And so the post-PEPRA people drive this rate up.
Particularly, again, it's a lot
on
of fees. Particularly when they're replacing people that weren't making any contributions because they had 30 years of service.
Okay, I got it.
Okay. What are we trying to get to today?
I think what we'd like to have on the table, if it's the county's pleasure as well, is to accept all the changes that Graham is recommending, except we phase in over 2 years the 2.13% due to the implementation of the new GASB methodologies. Does that sound correct?
So the choice would be either do it all today or phase it in over 2?
Yes, or, I mean, you could decide you don't want to implement GASB this year. I wouldn't recommend it. I don't think Graham would.
We put it off for quite a while.
Right.
Like,
right. I think this is a good way
I think
to
our prior discussion, and, I would benchmark what the county to the north was doing and phase it in over a 3-year period.
Graham, you'd indicated that this other thing that's coming at us is even bigger. If it hits, and
yeah,
that'll be phased in over.
Again, it's hard for me to make a comment like that without data, but I know all I'll say is that other systems have been seeing bigger hits than this from these other causes.
So if
like
we phase this in 2 years, the other one hits at that time. If we phase it in 3 years, we have both emitting?
That's true. You'd have overlap.
Would we?
Yeah, if you did this over 3 years, yeah.
If we did this over three years, yes,
right.
You would.
If you did this over 2 years, it would all be baked into place by the time you did the experience set in 2015.
That's right.
I think 2 years is plenty. Suppose we just split it. That would be 8.42% increase for 2 years. I'll make that motion.
Second.
Is this an action item?
Yes.
It is.
Yes.
So this is to give me direction to take the increase due to the change in the GASB and split it evenly over a 2-year period. Because these numbers might change slightly.
Does that include this two recommendations?
But
that's going to be roughly.
To me, to...
So,
yes.
I believe we have to do it, Maria.
Okay. Well, we go down.
I'm very satisfied
what
she's
saying.
So
his
motion was to... increase due to GASB phase in over 2 years.
This one.
The amortization period
is
staying exactly what it is.
Yeah. And next year,
two recommended changes to the economic assumptions.
Okay. That's not going to be phased in.
Call for a vote,
no,
Mr. Chairman.
Does that, the motion doesn't include that?
Question about the motion.
You want to ask that to make sure?
Yeah.
The maker of the motion.
Okay, ask the maker of the motion to restate
the motion. And I second it. Because my question was, does that include the two recommendations made? I have to say your name again.
Chiron.
Chiron. Incorporated the negotiated base pay and increased the expected interest crediting rate. Or are you just talking about phasing? Or are we just talking about phasing in the GASB process over 2 years?
I would recommend only the GASB because the other one is is only a 1-year thing. It's going to be in place next year anyway.
Okay.
That was my intent when I was answering your question, Jeff, was to just do the GASB piece.
Okay.
And so the maker of the motion, is that his intent too?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
And just to clarify, we're talking 22 years and 14 and then go down to 21 and 15 still.
Well, that's the
yeah. All you can do there is not make a change, and
yeah.
I think
yeah,
exactly
I mean,
continue with that.
That's not changing. Okay. So we have a motion. Did we have a second?
Yes, Maria seconded.
Yes. Maria seconded. Any discussion or questions?
Two-year phase in.
Okay. Call for the motion. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
No.
Oh, okay. One no.
Thank you.
Are you done?
I am finished.
that was enough. Okay. Okay. We go to Executive Director 2013 Quarter 4 Value Added Report.
I'm just going to give you a brief rundown of what we see. Just to remind you what value added is, value added concept is simply the excess returns. I know we don't like that term, so maybe we could use alpha, less the fees we pay to earn that alpha. And so, what's that? Let me rephrase it. So the excess returns, or alpha, is the return that the manager gets less the benchmark. So that's the excess return. And then from that number, we subtract out the custodial fees and the manager fees, see you, Graham, that we pay to achieve those returns, and that's the value that they add to the portfolio. So really fast, what the exhibits show this year, or this quarter, is that since June 30th, 2008, that all of our active managers have added positive value since that period of time. For the most recently completed quarter, the active managers added about $8.5 million in value above the benchmark, and for the last year, 2013, they added about $29.8 million in value above the benchmark after fees, which is very, very good. And then PIMCO was the only manager that actually didn't add value. They lost money after fees. Over the long term, small cap managers have provided the most value added, which makes sense because the small cap space is generally the less researched space. So that kind of bears out what we would expect to see from staff's results. Custodial fees have actually decreased over the last year for those managers that trade more than others, and that's reflective of the new fee structure that was put into place at the beginning of 2013. So that's working out very well. Our custodial fees took a huge bounce up in the first quarter of last year, which was a little embarrassing because we thought that we had negotiated a pretty good deal with Bank of New York Mellon, but it was a fluke essentially because the performance of the portfolio in the first quarter last year was very, very good. Those fees now have come back down to the point where we thought that they would be as the returns of the portfolio have returned to a more normal state. So that's very good. Stan Sarah's fees in terms of basis points to manage the total portfolio remain right around 35 basis points a year, which is very, very close to what we see with other 1937 Act systems. Nothing unusual there. And that's really all I have to say about this. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. All right.
I understand that the private equity is kind of different, and there's a J curve, which is a negative. But after a while, can they be added to this kind of report?
We can. Right now, it's just going to not make any sense.
Well, I know.
Stuff in there, but absolutely, we can stick something in there.
And he's eager to. I'm sure they all are eager to, because they don't make their money on what we've been talking about so far, the 1.3
right.
and a quarter. They
right.
make their money when they return us over 12%.
Right.
And so it's going to be
it's going to be
a
for everybody's benefit.
Skewed discussion anyhow, because it's going to be a lot more than any of these. But it's going to be two or three times what the return is on our industry.
We certainly hope so. Okay, where are we on the agenda?
Make a motion to move into closed session, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Second.
We have a second and a second. Mm-hmm. Who wants credit?
No, you don't need to leave.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I have credit.
Let's get the...
Motion was made by Darren Garrett and seconded by Mike O'Neill to accept staff recommendation as follows. Authorize executive director to sign consent form to amend the first amended and limited restated limited partnership agreement of the partnership for Raven Asset-Based Opportunity Fund 1 LP. Roll call vote is as follows. Gordon Ford, no. Donna Riley, yes. Maria DeAnda, yes. Jason Gordo, yes. Mike Lynch, yes. Jim DeMartini, yes. Darren Garrett, yes. Mike O'Neill, yes. Jeff Grover, yes. Motion passed.
Okay. Hmm. Members forum, I'd like to say that I really appreciate what staff did on this one for Raven. I'd like to see the same thing for the next two private equity people. You can do that. And that?
Nothing for me.
Nothing for me.
Just a comment about, we got an amended agenda for today. Can we in the future indicate on that amended agenda that it, that that's what it is? Just add the term amended to the agenda so we know that we don't get confused between the two.
We can. One thing really fast, that thing came in Friday at 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
No, I'm not.
No. We will totally do that. But just kind of make me feel better. We were scrambling so hard to get that thing out there. We had already given it to you guys.
Okay. That's the one. Oh, the other part of that is if you would somehow identify what's added, like you're using italic or bars in the margin.
In the past, we've had a discussion and I think a request from other board members on a cash flow reconciliation, monthly cash flow reconciliation. So when we see a change in the overall fund, we can know what came from investment gain or loss and what came from employer contributions and employee contributions are paid out. So can we just get to like a monthly?
We can. Information is actually available on one of these sheets in the quarterly value added. There's not going to be any employer contributions that's going to really show up because that just goes in one hand and out the other. But it definitely shows the losses.
Well, something that would tie to what that fund increase or decrease is.
An annual. Yeah, there's an annual summary.
Spend for members for their benefits plus the amount that they put in or whoever puts out less.
Gotcha.
Well, we made that monthly loss.
We do have that on this because there's a place on this one of these exhibits that show how much money was taken out of the fund
in total, but not broke down by the type.
So you're asking for two for us first, and I don't have a problem doing it. Trying to, I just want to ask a question. We basically. Scansera accounts for all of its finance and investment stuff, so you know, over here on this box, and all the member contribution stuff is over here on this box. And so what I hear you asking for is a breakdown on the member side. I guess I'm confused.
Okay.
In my mind,
the way it would look is employer contributions, employee contributions.
Mm-hmm.
Gains, losses, dividends, payouts, that sort of stuff, payments to retirees, and then there's a net number down at the bottom. And it should tie to what our fund balance is.
Okay, we'll work on it.
Why don't you bring what you have?
Right.
And then we'll
take it apart.
Yeah.
And we'll put
yeah.
it back together.
Okay.
Sounds good.
Good.
We'll
right.
work on it.
Do you want to do that kind of quietly, or do you want an agenda item? Or
no, I think it should be part of our report.
Okay.
I mean, if it's not something that's collected on a monthly basis, it sounds like you think you're doing it on a quarterly, at least quarterly, let's look at it.
Okay. So they'll bring something back for us to look at.
And from my standpoint, it could be a consent item, just so that it pops up so we can look at it and know what's going on.
We'll work on building you a good report.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
And we dedicated our new psychiatric hospital today. That's why I was late.
That's relieving.
It's finally done. It started when Jeff was on the board. We finally got it done. Sorry, it just conflicted with this meeting. So it wasn't that I forgot to come.
Do you have enough room for all of us?
About 16 minutes.
We're ready.
After today's meeting, I may take you up on that.
Can we put a limit on how long the meetings can be?
Good.
Yeah, and then the Patterson City Council.
I'm on my way to Arizona as soon as we break here, and I wanted to be on the road by 4, but that's not happening.
not happening. Okay, I take that as a pass. Donna?
And opening day is tomorrow? No, Thursday.
Spring training?
Training camp.
I boycott Arizona.
Mr. Garrett?
I deeded my time apparently to Jonah.
Mike?
It was 80 degrees in Tucson.
Staff, anything?
I'm still deeding my time.
We stand adjourned.